this is Jay Reel, director of Dawn, and you're listening to the Gut Munchers podcast. It's good stuff.
Hey, it's episode 14 of the Gut Munchers podcast. With me this time around is my good buddy from the land of the rising sun, Jason.
Yes. Hello, guys.
How you doing?
I'm a little tired. I just woke up about an hour ago, so I'm kind of like just barely making it today.
Jeez, 6 o'clock at night, you slacker.
I know. Well, hey, here it's 7 in the morning, so
nice.
on Monday morning, so I don't even know what day it is.
You working today? It's,
No, today I didn't have to work. Yesterday I had to go to school for in Japan they have a thing called Sports Day, and so everybody has to go and support the kids as they perform their little activities, and so I had to go to that. So because everybody goes to that, you have Monday off, so there you go.
Cool.
Yeah, not too bad.
Excellent. Well, we've got a great show. Yes, we do. We have the interview with independent filmmaker and Ohio legend J.R. Bookwalter.
Yes, J.R.'s in the hizzy.
Yes, he is. And then in addition to that, we're going to talk a little bit about J.R.'s zombie opus. That would be The Dead Next Door. And then to change things up, I want to talk to you before we talk about the other movie we're going to review. I hear that I've seen the video, but you picked up, by the way, if you guys don't watch our videos on YouTube, you really should, because there's some good stuff there. But you had picked up some Blue Underground titles.
Right, yes, yeah, I did.
What all did you get?
Let's see. I picked up Uncle Sam, which we'll be talking about later on in the show.
Yep.
Picked up Violent City, starring Charles Bronson.
Cool.
Also picked up Bone, the first Larry Conan movie.
Cool.
Picked up Maniac, another William Lustig joint.
Cool.
I picked up, let's see, what else did I pick up? Two Evil Eyes, Romero and Argento.
Cool.
I picked up, man, it seemed like I had a ton of stuff. I'm trying to remember everything. Hold on, I got the stack right here. And then I also picked up The Crazies.
Ah, The Crazies.
Yes. And maybe a few more. I can't remember everything. I don't want to, like, just, like, the whole time. But
okay.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. So, yeah, I had about, like, maybe 8 of them, I think.
You and I, I'm going to tell you right now. I'm setting something in stone right now. Now, if you guys haven't figured out the format, Jason does one show a month with me. Ed does the other show a month. We do 2 a month. So this would be not for the next show, but the show after that. You and I need to review The Crazies. I love that movie.
Yeah, I've never seen it, so
Have you not watched it yet?
No, I'm plugging through right now. I got about. Oh, there's about 3 or 4 movies probably ahead of that. I'm still trying to get through.
Well, let's plan on the next show that we do after this one, you and I. We'll have The Crazies as one of the movies to review. Deal?
Yeah, that sounds fine, man. I'm getting all excited just thinking about it.
Because I love The Crazies. In fact, the last time I saw The Crazies, this past weekend was I didn't get to go out to Pittsburgh to the big drive-in convention. There's a drive-in not a really convention, but there's a drive-in called Riverside Drive-In that's northeast of Pittsburgh. But we went last year, and they showed in the drive-in a quadruple feature of, I think, Cry of the Banshee or something like that. Cry of the Banshee, Frogs. Those two movies were okay. Frogs is actually a crap movie. I hate it. but then they showed Night of the Living Dead, and then they finished the night off with The Crazies on film.
Man, that is awesome. I do remember you mentioning that last time we hung out at Wasteland or whatever, so that sounds awesome.
I love
awesome.
The Crazies. I think The Crazies is one of Romero's most underappreciated films.
Oh, yeah?
So, yeah, dude. I'll be very shocked and ready to rip you a new one if you don't like it. So be prepared.
Yeah, well, like I said, I'm definitely looking forward to checking it out, that's for sure. And, you know, it's one of those movies that just, you know, because when I first found out, you know, I stumbled upon Romero however many years ago, mm-hmm. you know, just like most people, it was like almost exclusively his zombie movies that I was into. So now I'm going back and righting that wrong by watching all of his films and not just his zombie ones.
Well, a lot of them are crap. I love Romero, but, I mean, you know, Season of the Witch is not a good movie. But The Crazies, right. Dude. When you watch The Crazies, do me a favor. Watch it I think maybe it was Ed and I talking on the last show about Romero. I don't know if it made it the air, it made the cut. But The Crazies is kind of like a transitional movie for us between Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead. You can kind of feel the vibe of Dawn of the Dead starting The Crazies.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, dude, I'll be excited to hear what you say.
I'll be looking forward to it for sure.
Cool. So, and then I guess, like you said, the other movie that we're going to review is a Blue Underground film. And, of course, as you can tell from the Blue Underground show, and I don't know if we talked about this one on the Blue Underground show, but it is one of our favorite companies here at Gut Munchers. And it is the William Lustig directed and Larry Cohen written Uncle Sam. Mm-hmm. I want Uncle you Sam. Dead.
Dead. Exactly. Classic.
Yeah, I just actually got – I'm looking at my DVD cover right now. Did you get the one that's all, like, lenticular and shiny?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it doesn't do the lenticular thing, I don't think. No, it's just the regular cover, I think.
Mine's like
a hologram,
actually, not lenticular, I should say.
But. Yeah, mine doesn't – mine, like, moves a little bit. I don't know. To be quite honest, I haven't really looked at it that much. I was – you know, I just put it in the player and started watching it because I've been – wanted to see it forever, so.
I'm glad you picked this one because I used to watch this one on VHS and I've seen it a lot. But when I went to grab my DVD, to watch it again for the show, and I realized my DVD. This is one of my probably from a couple years ago sale purchases from Deep Discount, and it still had the seal on it.
Oh, really? You had never even opened it.
I hadn't even cracked it open, so I cracked it open. Actually, right before we did the show, and watched it again.
That's great.
So, yeah, I'm excited, dude. Uncle Sam.
That's great.
I'm excited to talk about it. I don't know that I'm a huge fan of the movie, but I think there's some cool stuff with it. So, I'm excited to talk about this, and I'm excited to chat about J.R. Bookwalter's Dead Next Door. They're dead.
Yes.
They're next door, and it's funky.
It is very funky.
Funky. So. Cool. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm ready to get this sucker rolling.
Yeah, let's get cracking.
So why don't we take a quick break, and when we come back, as is our tradition here at Gut Munchers, we'll lead off with the interview, because that way if you have no interest in listening to Jason and I drone on about stuff, you can hear the interview and get out quick.
Right. The most important thing.
Yeah, the most important thing. But up next will be an interview with J.R. Bookwalter, and I think it's about 70 minutes long, so it's about an hour and 10 minutes. We talk about his entire career. We talk about The Dead Next Door and Tempe Home Video and a bunch of other cool stuff that he's involved in. So, again, we'll be back right after this, and we'll launch into the J.R. Bookwalter interview. I reckon you guys know this already, but I'm going to tell you again, you're listening to the Gut Munchers podcast.
Hello? Is anyone out there? This is Brother D. Is anyone else alive? You know, you'd think with all the zombie movies I watch and review for Mail Order Zombie over at www.mailorderzombie.com, I would have been better prepared for the zombie uprising. I mean, every week I'd watch anywhere from 1 to 3 zombie movies, and my wife, Miss Bren, would join me in every episode to go over listener mail and even occasionally join me in a review of a zombie movie herself. But now, we woke up one morning and the zombies have taken over. Miss Bren went scouting for supplies, but she's been gone a long time. So I went out to look for her, and now I just wish I'd stay home and watched more zombie movies for everyone, weeding out the good ones from the bad. What? Wait a minute. Who's there? Miss Bren? You're not Miss Bren. Oh no.
Send more podcasters.
Watch out, mister. Here comes the twister.
This is Rudy Ray Moore.
Yes, I'm the human tornado. I chain down thunder and handcuff lightning. I'm so damn strong, it's sometimes frightening. I grabbed a star traveling a million miles a minute and slowed it down to the state speed limit. Yes, I'm the human tornado. Spinning, grinning, and sinning. I used an earthquake to mix my milkshake. I eat an avalanche when I want ice cream. I punched a hurricane and made it a breeze. I swallowed an iceberg and didn't freeze. The human tornado. Bringing cash and talking trash. Feed me, delayed, relayed, mislaid, and parlayed. Jump, thump, bumped, and mugwump. The human tornado. Rated R. Under 17, not admitted without a parent or a note from your jailer.
Well, okay, the first thing that I always ask filmmaker when I interview them is, what was your inspiration? What planted the thought in your mind, hey, I'm going to pick up a camera and go shoot a film?
Well, I mean, I was born at that perfect age when I think I was 11 years old when Star Wars came out. So, I mean, that of course, was inspired, you know, many thousands of people to probably do the same thing. But that was really I think that was the first movie that I remember thinking, you know, wow, I want to do that. That was so cool. I've got to, like, you know, try and do the same thing. And I was probably more of a science fiction nut at that point than I was with horror, although I had grown up, you know, watching Dark Shadows on TV and stuff like that. So I was certainly had an interest in horror, but sci-fi was kind of like, you know, the thing I was most interested in until I have to blame it on Fangoria magazine when that first issue of Fangoria came out, which was kind of like half sci-fi and half horror. But they had an article on Tom Savini doing the makeup effects for Dawn of the Dead and before the movie had ever come out. And I saw that, like, zombie's head blowing off with the shotgun and all these cool images, and I was like, whoa, you know. And that was the thing that sort of warped my mind. And next thing you know, much to my parents' dismay, all my short films after that were horror themed, and how we could kill the neighborhood kids and my pets and whatever I could get my hands on. So yeah, that was it was science fiction early on. It was Star Wars was the first one, but Dawn of the Dead was sort of the one that led me down the path of horror.
So you shot a lot of shorts as a kid, or a lot of shorter films growing up?
Yeah, I think between age 10 or 11, probably to college, I had done 50 some odd short films. I mean, a few of them were, you know, I would start and not finish. And in college, I did one called Go Insane. It was kind of inspired by the Lindsey Buckingham album of the same name. But that one was like 20 minutes. That was sort of the epic, that the only, you know, the longest thing I had done prior to Dead Next Door. But yeah, I was always shooting something. I mean, when, you know, during the MTV days, I would get into more of the music video thing, and I would shoot a lot of music videos, and it was a challenge trying to cut images to music, especially back in those days. You know, it was all Super 8 film, you know, which was quite a challenge to work with compared to what they have now. These kids don't know how good they have it. But yeah, so I kept busy, you know. I mean, I was always shooting stuff, and when I wasn't shooting stuff, I was making little fanzines and all kinds of goofy stuff. So I had a very active childhood, I guess.
So when you decided to do a feature, was it always going to be a horror film?
No, well, I mean, I was not the one who sort of pushed myself in that direction. I have to say, I think after college, I quit. I went to the Art Institute of Pittsburgh right out of high school, and at the beginning of the second year of school there, my apartment had been robbed, and I kind of just took that as a sign that maybe this wasn't for me, because I was taking photography classes at the time. They didn't have any film classes, and so I quit, and I came back home and, you know, lived with my mother again, and it's just, she was sort of like, go get a job, and I was
Moms are good for that, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Try to push me into whatever she wanted me to do. And I think I was kind of like just thinking, well, maybe I'll take the George Romero route and try and do industrial films or commercials locally or whatever. And I wasn't having a lot of luck with that. And really within you know, a short amount of time after quitting college is when I kind of stumbled into this arrangement with the Master Cylinder, as we will call him, and that's what led to Dead Next Door. And it all happened, you know, it was within 2 or 3 months after quitting college. I, you know, basically had the first check in my hand to start that movie. So, but it was kind of like I was more eager to just work on anything, and he was the guy that sort of said, well, you should just make your own movie. And I was like, what do you mean? You know, and he's like, well, if you get something going, let me know, and I'll kick some money into it. And I'm one of those people, you don't have to tell me twice, because I'm like, okay. Next thing you know, I'm sitting down trying to do a budget, trying to put an investment proposal together, and you know, and lo and behold, obviously it happened. So it exists all these years later still. So
the effects are actually pretty decent and pretty gory and solid. And when you were shooting it, were you trying to go for the gore effect? Were you inspired by like a Romero type film, or were you just trying to shoot something like you said?
Oh no, I was definitely. I mean, once the Master Cylinder had put this idea in my head of making my own movie, I knew exactly what I wanted to make. And Dead Next Door actually kind of started as a sort of sequel to a short film I had done back in 1980 called Zombie, which was, of course, obviously a liberal ripoff of Fulci's Zombie and the Romero movies. And so that was kind of like I took some of the character names like Dr. Bo and Anna and some of that. So I took elements from that. I mean, it wasn't a literal sequel, but I took things from that and then wrote the script for Dead Next Door very quickly. I mean, I think the first draft was written in just a few days, because I basically came home from this meeting in Detroit where I was told that, you know, maybe this guy will kick in some money. And I took my old manual typewriter and started, you know, banging it out. And it just came to me. Back then, I had all these crazy ideas, and they were constantly spilling out of my head and onto paper. So I've just got, you know, loosely folders of stacked to the ceiling of all these crazy ideas that I had when I was younger. So, but no, I mean, I was a huge fan of Romero's Zombie trilogy and even Fulci's, you know, Zombie 2 sequel and stuff like that. And it was, you know, I knew I was always going to make a real zombie movie, or if I ever got the chance to make a feature, that was something I wanted to do. Day of the Dead, I think, had been shot and was in the process of, they were marketing it or whatever. It was about to come out around that same time. So that was, of course, a big inspiration. And, Dead Next Door just kind of was like, I took from this and that and other things, you know, different things that I would, you know, I would see around me or read around me. I mean, the subject of AIDS as a disease was just coming into the news at the time, and, you know, it was kind of scary, this whole, like, virus that there's no cure for, and that kind of played into the whole zombie virus and the fact that the zombies in Dead Next Door couldn't be killed. It wasn't like you could just shoot them in the head and stuff like that. That I would, you know, play around with ideas like that. And I know early on, we had gone to Washington, D.C. to scout locations, just kind of look around and see if we could shoot anything down there, because I wanted to set some of the footage down there. Mm-hmm. And I was just – that was the first time I'd ever been there, and I was just floored at how there were people protesting anything you could possibly imagine. There were protesters in front of the White House protesting for it. And that's – when I went down there, that's where the idea came to me that, well, you know, why shouldn't these people be protesting for zombie rights? That just makes sense. The idiots will protest for anything. And so just a little – you know, little ideas like that, even like the concept of the zombie squad driving around out in the, you know, sort of Midwest areas. It came from I was driving a lot in college between Pittsburgh and Akron, which is a couple hour drive. And just, you know, your mind starts to wander when you're driving and come up with all these crazy ideas. So anyways, it was a collection of things from my life, as well as ideas that I had that I thought were sort of unique on, take on the zombie idea. But I wanted to be kind of grounded in the Romero mythos, but not, you know, necessarily completely rip it off like some movies have. Or it would be lovingly ripped off, I guess. An homage as opposed to blatantly ripping it off, you know. And I figured I was a fan, so I could throw my hat into the ring and see what, you know, I had a couple. Because, you know, the thing about the Romero movies, as much as I love them, they were always very claustrophobic. You were always in that one location. And to me, it was always like you would see those glimpses of, like in Dawn of the Dead, all those great glimpses of the, you know, all the redneck hunters out, you know, hunting zombies and stuff like that. And that stuff to me was always the more interesting stuff. And it set my imagination in overdrive, I guess, because that's what I wanted to see, is what's happening beyond the scope of what's actually in the movie. You know, the movies, of course, were great, but I wanted to see the other events that were taking place. And I think that's the stuff that inspired more of the things in Dead Next Door that probably went into, I know a lot of people use the word epic, even though, you know, could it be when we didn't have a lot of money, but that's what, you know, those ideas, I wanted to see that stuff. I wanted to see all this zombie devastation and see some of the events that take place. That was the more interesting stuff for me, I guess.
Okay. What was it like, or how did you go about, and this is another interesting question I always like to ask, casting a low-budget movie like that, especially in somewhere like Akron, which I'm an Ohio guy too, so I'm familiar with the area. Did you use local people? Did you bring people in? And how did you get the cast together?
Well, there were actually several phases of cast, because when we started, I think it's the beginning of September of 85 was when we got the first money. So it's like literally 24 years ago from the day we're speaking here. But that we did the first round of casting, and we basically had the whole cast locked. And then we hit the winter time and we couldn't shoot. So basically over that winter of 85, 86, people got impatient and moved on to other things, and we lost the majority of that cast. I would say probably 80% of that cast wandered off and did other things because we just didn't have it together. And so we wound up having to almost completely recast the movie the following spring, in order to get going, you know, by summertime. And, but yeah, it was pretty much all local people. The one I was having a problem trying to find a sort of reliable co-producer person to help me, because I just was way in over my head, and I had asked the Master Cylinder for any recommendations he had, and he wound up enlisting this girl, Jolie Jacunis from Detroit, who had done a couple little things there, and she had a real solid background in, you know, as a production manager and that kind of thing, but she was also an actress. So when she came down, I was having trouble filling that role, and I kind of, you know, said, look, you know, I know you were brought down here to do this stuff to help me produce this thing, but how would you like to play this role? And so she kind of filled in there, and then we brought in Scott Spiegel, you know, who I had met from that whole group up in Detroit. And that was, he was kind of like our star, you know. It's like he had actually done other things out in the world that we had actually seen. And so bringing him down was kind of our cool celebrity, the only celebrity we could afford anyways. But the rest of it was cast around here. I mean, it was all just local people. And, you know, I mean, I hate to say it, but no offense to any of the actors, because they all worked so hard and did such a good job. But, you know, some of them were obviously had never acted before. But, you know, we took a chance on them. They had the right look or just whatever, you know. So, I mean, it was, I think at that point I had not made enough movies, I don't think, where I was so focused on the acting as much. You know, to me it was like the acting was just kind of like scenes to get from one effect to another. I'm not ashamed to admit that. My later movies I kind of figured it out a little bit more, like, oh, you got to work with these actors and you got to get them to do this, that, and the other. And, you know, I got better with actors as time went on. But with Dead Next Door, it was, you know, just starting out, it was, I didn't know anything and they didn't know anything. You know what I mean? I was the most knowledgeable person on that movie, just because I had, you know, made all these short films. But that, in the grand scheme of things, that didn't really mean anything.
Was distribution hard, or how hard was it to get the movie out there? And did you get it in any theaters, or did it go like to a video?
No, well, I mean, the problem was, again, it was kind of the same problem we had with the casting. The movie took so freaking long to finish that people had essentially just forgotten about it by the time it was done, because it was about 4 years from the time I had actually first gotten that money to the time where we had finished it. You know, it was like September of 85, I think, when I got the first chunk of dough, and it was the spring of 89, I think, when we actually finally did the final sound mix and laid the audio on the master and called it a day. So it was, you know, there was such a long period of time. Most people had just like I said, they had moved on and forgotten all about this movie. In fact, sort of ironic side story, the Akron Beacon Journal, which is the big paper in this area, mm-hmm. they had done a lot of coverage of Dead Next Door early on, and they kind of slapped us on the wrist when it came time to do our second movie, because we had brought them out to the set of Robot Ninja to try and get them to do some coverage. And they did this, instead of doing the coverage so much on the fact that we had done the second movie, they were kind of, the whole article was about whatever happened to the first movie. You know, it's like, why were we making a second movie when the first one hadn't come out? And the reality was, it was kind of out of my hands, because, you know, I had had this investor from Detroit, and he was trying to finagle some deals here and there. And that took, I think it was like another year probably from the time it was finished in 89 to when it actually came out. And unfortunately, when it came out, it was a small label out of North Carolina. It was really a guy who was a filmmaker himself that was trying to self-distribute his own movies. And so they, you know, we gave them Dead Next Door, thinking, well, you know, they seemed eager and they wanted to push it, and they liked the movie and everything. And they had their movie was Super 8 too, so it was sort of like we felt kind of a kinship with them. But unfortunately, it just, you know, it wasn't very good distribution back then. You know, it got seen enough, because obviously enough people heard about it, but it wasn't like it came out from a, you know, Vestron Video or one of the predominant labels back in those days.
Does it surprise you that all these years later that it still has the legs that it has, and it's still, I mean, it's not just even a regional thing. It's pretty well known.
I'm constantly surprised, because, like I was alluding to just a second ago, I mean, the distribution, originally it was out of my hands. Somebody else was doing it, and then eventually I kind of took it under my wing and tried to get it out there, and it's been bungled all the way down the line. I mean, all the deals were never very good, and it was just the fact that anybody ever saw it. I don't think when I was making it, the thought even crossed my mind. I was so focused on the task at hand of making the movie that it never occurred to me that people might actually see this thing when we're done. And I think it was Film Threat Video Guide, the now defunct Film Threat Video Guide, was the one of the first places that actually did a printed review of it. And and it was a fairly glowing review. And I just remember like being flabbergasted, like, oh my gosh, I can't believe, you know, people are actually going to see this thing now, especially since the time span of finishing that movie and jumping right in to the second movie was so short that I kind of was like, after 4 years of messing around with that thing, I was really just focused on moving on, and kind of like whatever happened with that first movie was its own, you know, it wasn't going to be any part of mine. I wasn't going to, you know, we found it a home, and that was the least I could do, and whatever. And so it really, it's not like I went to conventions and I was out hyping the movie and promoting it, you know, like you see so many people doing now. I didn't do anything. It just, the audience found it. Cool. You know, people found the movie, and that was kind of the coolest part of it, was that it was a natural occurrence. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't anything forced. It was just, you know, people found it and people liked it and started sharing with their friends and so on and so on. And as the commercial goes, and that's how people found it. So it was mostly through bootleg copies at the beginning, but,
that's a drag.
No, but it's not because, you know, back then it was VHS tapes and shipping it through mail and stuff. It's not like you could just go to BitTorrent and download it or whatever, but true, like we have now. But there were enough copies floating around out there, and enough people were showing it to their friends that, you know, when people could find it, they actually were, you know, willing to buy a copy of it. And I still to this day, I mean, people come up to me at conventions and like, oh my gosh, I've been looking for this everywhere, and you know, and it's kind of funny. So yeah, I mean, I'm constantly surprised that anybody sees, when people tell me they've seen it, I'm like, you know, I just can't believe it. Especially all these years later, it's really the one movie I've made out of all of them that has totally had its life of its own. You know, it's almost like I don't have to really do much to nudge it along, because it just exists.
Cool. Yeah, being an Ohio guy and being a guy that grew up in this area and a huge fan of zombie films, I've had a VHS copy of it, a legitimate VHS copy of it since college. So
hey, there you go. Yeah, and that's back in the days when it was expensive. Exactly. Yeah. You really had to, like, you know, you were shelling out $40 or whatever for a VHS tape. You were, you know, really making a commitment. It's not like buying something for $5 at the Walmart bin anymore.
Yeah. So it's interesting to me that you do this. It takes you 4 years. You complete this zombie film, which is just, yeah, like I say, a very large-scale zombie film. And I've not, I'm going to be honest with you, I've not seen Robot Ninja, but I'm absolutely, like, intrigued by the fact that that was your next project. Were you just burned out on horror, or like, or were you a big sci-fi fan, or was this just another movie you really wanted to make?
Well, see, that's the deception. Is Robot Ninja actually is very, is probably the goriest movie I've made. It's actually very gory, dark. I mean, I hesitate to call it a horror movie. I don't know, but it's not really fantasy or science fiction. I don't. Horror is probably the best category for it. But the title wasn't mine. I had made this deal with Cinema Home Video. Who I had met Dave Dakota, the guy who was running Cinema Home Video out there while I was mixing the sound for Den Next Door, and I kind of started hitting him up for work, and it was just, it was so easy, the whole process, and he and I sat down, and you know, I had a couple projects I wanted to do, but I didn't want to do anything that was in the budget range that he was talking about, because it was a lot less money than Dead Next Door wound up costing, and it was going to be done quick and on 16mm, and you know, so I was kind of like, you know, I don't want to waste any of my projects at the time. So he threw out this title, Robot Ninja, and I was like, eh, you know, because he always had, I had a list of titles of films that he thought would, sounded good that he wanted to make or get made. So I said, okay, you know, whatever. I was so eager to just get another gig, you know, to make something, that I said, I'll do it. And, you know, and then pretty much immediately knew that I didn't want to make the same Robot Ninja that he wanted to make. You know, I'm sure he had a completely different idea in mind. Like, you know, in my movie, there is no ninja robot. You know, it's a totally different, total departure from what you think the movie would be about. But, no, I mean, to me, it was a logical extension. It wasn't. I looked at it as another horror movie, so it wasn't any different.
You shot that in Ohio too?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, and then that deal led to me producing Skinned Alive, which was a friend of mine, John Kilo, who's from Rittman, Ohio. He had this script, and I thought it was hilarious, and I pitched it to Cinema Home Video basically while we were, I think, editing Robot Ninja, and he greenlit it, and we got started on that. It was kind of a nice flow because they were, you know, the movies were kind of rolling one into the other. And then I think we were supposed to do a third one called Ghoul School here, and that actually wound up happening in New Jersey, and I was sort of only peripherally involved in it. I kind of bailed out of it. And Cinema Home Video wound up making it anyways, and then I came in at the end to sort of help put it together in the post production end. Mm-hmm. But those first three were all done in Ohio.
And then you moved on. I guess the next movie you directed was Zombie Cop.
No, well, technically Kingdom of the Vampire.
Okay.
I had moved to LA in. Let me see. It must have been spring of 1990, because we had done these movies with Cinema Home Video, and they had released all this stuff, and it just, they weren't seeing the money back fast enough or whatever. And they had offered me a gig out there for a couple of months doing some editing and this and that and other stuff, you know, because I had expressed interest in moving out there. So I figured, well, it's a no-brainer. If I've got, you know, somebody's going to at least give me a salary for a couple of months, I might as well go out there and get settled in and, you know, try and make the move. And I wound up, I think after a year or so, probably about a year and a half, deciding, this really isn't my thing. I'm going to get back and make movies again. And, you know, I wasn't doing what I wanted to do. I was shopping around trying to get other movie deals and stuff, but nothing was happening. So I had this grandiose idea that the next thing to do was going to be to shoot movies on video. Mm-hmm. And I had eyeballed this sort of, you know, mid-range camera that I thought was the ideal thing and had the picture quality I wanted and everything. And so my goal was I was going to move back to Ohio and I was going to start making movies on video. This was my big brainstorm. Anyways, the guy from Cinema Home Video, you know, I don't know if he took pity on me or he thought it was a good idea or whatever, but at the time he had this deal with this company called Rentrak, which was doing a lot of business with his VHS tapes. It was a newer company, and they basically did revenue sharing deals to mom and pop video stores back when there were still enough of those to have a business model. And he was making some good money. So he again threw out these titles. He's like, well, why don't you make a couple movies for me? I'll throw you some work and kind of get you started. And he's like, well, I'll give you $5,000 and you got to make me two movies, Kingdom of the Vampire and Zombie Cop. And I'm like, oh, okay, at least they're horror movies. I could do something with that. So moved back to Ohio, got this all set up, you know, got the scripts written, and basically that was the start of a very dark period in my life where I wound up regretting, because it wound up being, there were 6 movies in 7 months, you know, from the summer of 91 to, like, spring of 92. And that was sort of like the, you know, the end for me. I kind of got out my white flag and waved it and said, I'm done. I don't want to even make movies anymore. It's like, what have I done to myself? This is the most horrendous experience ever. And, you know, it started okay. Kingdom of the Vampire was, although I should have known, because I think it was like the first or second night of shooting on that movie where I actually broke my knee, trying to set up a shot. And it, from the, you know, the rest of the shoot, I had to direct the stupid thing out of a wheelchair, and it was just a nightmare. It's like I should have known that you know, that was an omen of things to come, of how bad it was going to get.
How did you break your knee?
Well, I don't know if it was actually broken. I never actually had it. We got it wrapped up or whatever, and it wound up healing itself. But it was we were in this tiny little attic at the top of this 3-story house, and there was this. I couldn't have been more than four inch space or 5 inch space between the wall and the bed. And I'm trying to set up the shot where the vampire kid comes in to put a stake in his mother's heart or try to. And I don't know what it was. I had my legs turned a certain way, and I turned to set the camera up on a tripod. And all of a sudden I blacked out and like fell straight over on the bed. And I heard this horrendous crunching noise in my left knee. And, what a nightmare, because, I mean, I hear I'm at the top of this 3-story house, and it's an old house, you know, a really old house. So the crew members are trying to carry me downstairs, and the slightest little pressure on my leg at that point, I was just in screaming agony. It's just, I don't have fond memories of that shoot at all. So it was, it was not fun, but anyways.
So you knocked the 6 movies out for him, and the last of them...
Humanoids from Atlantis,
okay.
A gem, an epic. These movies, all except for Kingdom of the Vampire, the other 5 have since been regurgitated as this Bad Movie Police label that I started a few years back, where we shot these little intros with these fake movie cops, these, you know, kind of goth chicks that run around arresting bad filmmakers, and started as a inside joke that anytime I'd hear a police siren, I'm like, oh, the Bad Movie Police are coming to get us. And, So the Humanoids from Atlantis was the last one, and that was just such a nightmare and such a fiasco. I mean, it wasn't even a feature. It wound up being like 45 minutes long because we were trying to shoot this thing about this, you know, obviously a Humanoids from the Deep knockoff, where we're shooting it, I think, in March in Ohio, where there's like still snow on the ground. You know, and it's like too cold for anybody. The guy in the creature suit can't even get in the water, you know, and it's just a nightmare. And that was really the one where I just sort of like gave up. I mean, at one point I think we threw the script out and just made up the whole ending because we couldn't shoot what I had written. So yeah, those were dark days. But you learn from those. Whatever does not kill you makes you stronger, so they say.
Well, then you came back with a movie that I personally kind of get a kick out of and enjoy. And I don't know if the timing, if this is actually the one you came back with. Then you shot Ozone.
Yep, Ozone was the next one, and that was a total fluke. There was a couple guys from Canton that had worked on Dead Next Door early on, and they had wound up quitting or whatever during the pre-production, so they'd never actually worked on the movie. But the one guy, Doug Snoffer, who has since gone on to write a bunch of stuff for me, he had the script by his friend Dave Wagner, and he brought it to me, and because they were looking to get it made, and they were, you know, thinking maybe I was like, you know, the guy making movies in this area, maybe they could enlist me to do whatever. You know, I didn't even know what they wanted me to do. And they had a couple grand or whatever they were going to spend to try and make this. And I remember reading the script. I think I was like, I was driving out west. So I wasn't driving. I was riding in a car and reading it. And on my way to a Fangoria convention. That's my only memory of it, but as a vendor for the Tempe video. Mm-hmm. And I read the script and I thought, man, I want to make this. You know, the heck with these guys. I want to make this script. And I don't know what it was about it, but as I read it, I visualized it perfectly in my mind and pretty much was, you know, close to what – it's the movie that was the closest to what my image of it was going to be as far as how it turned out, which almost never happens because there's just too many obstacles and too much – I'm not saying it's 100%. Perfect match to what my original idea was, but I, you know, so anyways, I went back from this convention, from this trip, and I called those guys and I said, hey, you know, what would you think if I just made this movie? I said, you guys could kick in the money you have and I'll kick in, you know, I'll match and kick in some money and we'll just make the thing. And this guy, Dave, who totally didn't have any ego about it, was like almost breathing a sigh of relief, like, oh, thank God, because I, you know, he had started to shoot some footage of it that, you know, looked promising, like he had some good ideas and stuff, but he didn't want to actually go follow through and do the execution of it. It's, you know, as anyone who has done it will attest to, it's grueling making movies, especially when you have no money and, you know, not a lot of time and all that kind of stuff. But so long story short, I talked him into making that, and that was the movie that sort of made me realized, yes, I still wanted to do this, and this was, I was going to, you know, I intentionally set out that I'm going to show people that, yes, I can make a movie, and Humanoids from Atlantis is not going to be my last cinematic word, and it worked. I mean, I, you know, people saw it, and enough people were impressed by it that I, you know, was inspired to continue doing it, so.
What kind of budget did it have? Purpose.
It was like $3,500 was the cash. Yeah, that was the cash on hand. I mean, we, you know, I pulled and begged and borrowed favors from all over the place. I mean, you know, most of that money, I think like $1,000 of that money went into there was a German music composer who I desperately wanted to use. He had done the Violent Shit 2, I think, one of mm-hmm. those movies. And I had liked his score, and I was like, man, if I could get this guy's music in this movie, that would, like, lift it to a whole nother level. And sure enough, you know, he delivered this great score. And it was totally worth the money because that really lifted the movie into another dimension as well.
That's a heck of a movie for $3,500.
Yeah, I mean, that's easily the one that I can certainly say, you know, that was every cent of that was well spent. Because, you know, you hear $3,500 and your expectations are low. I mean, even at that time, that was a ridiculous amount of money to attempt. I mean, it was the goal was... You know, like we had shot these movies two at a time for Cinema Home Video, like Zombie Cop and Kingdom of the Vampire. You know, those were two movies done for $5,000 total. And I was just determined to, like, take about the same amount of money but spend more time on the movie. This was my theory that I could make a better movie if I had the same amount of money and just a little bit more time. You know, take my time with it and not have to rush it through for some ridiculous release schedule or whatever. 'Cause, you know, those movies were so rushed. We were designing the VHS box cover before we had ever shot one frame of film or video. Okay. I mean, we were making up these drawn covers, and there were no pictures on the back because we didn't know who was going to be in the movie. Even half the time the credits on those boxes were wrong, you know, and we had these grandiose synopses that were written, and most of the time most of that stuff wasn't even in the movie because they had to do that because that was their release schedule. Those were scheduled so tight. So with Ozone, I was like, I want to do this as much the right way as I can, you know, given and take everything that I've learned and all the stuff that I had at my disposal, which, you know, wasn't much, but it's, you know, I certainly was happy with it. I mean, went way beyond my expectations of it at the time.
So had you started Tempe by this point?
Yeah, that was why it was basically Ozone was started. I had started the Tempe as a mail order thing during the time we were shooting Zombie Cop and Kingdom and all that stuff, because those deals, part of my deal with those movies was make the movie and then they'll give me like 100 copies of each movie for free, and I could do whatever I want with them. So my brainstorm was, oh, well, I'll start this mail order company and I'll start going to conventions and I'll sell these, you know, 10 or 15 bucks a pop or whatever I can get for them. And then I'll make, that's how I'll make actual money on these movies, because I, you know, given make, trying to make two movies for $5,000, obviously I'm not paying any bills with that.
Yeah.
And, so that's how Tempe was initially started. And the first thing I put out was, going back to, I think 1987, I had done this how-to video called Basic How-To Halloween Makeups, and we had thrown it together just before Halloween of that year and tried to sell it in local costume shops and stuff. And anyways, we did an overhaul of that and shot a second one, and that was the first stuff that I had officially put out on my own.
Okay.
And then by that point, I had been picking up movies from other producers, and so Ozone was kind of like the my first big release that we were going to do, where it was like, you know, I made this, I own this, and we're gonna put this thing out and try and do it right. And I had actually had a couple of small offers from labels that I don't even think exist anymore. You know, like one I think one label had offered me like 10 grand for it, and I'm thinking, it's tempting, but somehow I think I could make, I could do better. You know, I could make more money on it myself. And ultimately, that was a much smarter move than selling it off to somebody else. That was certainly Ozone, because it cost nothing, you know, went on to probably be one of my more profitable ventures for sure.
Cool. And you made three movies in a row that I really enjoy. I'm a big fan of Dead Next Door, but Ozone was the first one. And then you did one called Sandman, which can you talk a little bit about it, the setting, and where that came from? Because that, it just, I don't know why, but I just really dig that movie.
Well, you're in the minority. I'm not sure that movie's particularly well liked. Well, I don't know. You know, I just put it out on DVD a couple years ago and sold a ton of them, like much to my surprise, because when we put it out on VHS, it flopped. You know, it bombed. It did nothing. And it just kind of was one of those things that just has languished forever. And I don't know if it just needed better cover art or maybe passage of time or whatever. But I had finished Ozone and started selling it, and things were going really well with that. And this was, I think, 94 by this point. I think it was January 94 is when I started actually selling Ozone. And most of that year, I was just focused on the distribution thing and not really thinking about the next movie. And then I was talking to some of the guys that worked with me, and we started talking about, well, you know, let's do another movie, and what could we do? And I had pulled out all these old scripts, and anyways, The Sandman had dated back to a few years prior. A friend of mine, Dave Lang, and I had come up with the original story for it, and I had actually met Matthew Jason Walsh, who wrote the script, through the pages of Fangoria, one of these goofy classified ads or whatever. He had an ad in there looking to write. So I had actually brought him to Ohio and put him up in my office at the time and hired him to write The Sandman back in, I don't know, it was years before it actually wound up getting made.
Mm-hmm.
Long story short. But I decided, you know, out of everything I had, that was the one that I was going to do next. Now, the big mistake I made was I had my eye on Blockbuster Video, because at the time that was like the crown jewel of, you know, trying to get your movie into.
Yeah.
And I hadn't done it with Ozone, and I thought, I want to make something that's a little bit more, I want to make a horror movie, but I want to make something that's a little less in your face. You know, like Ozone was probably a little too in your face for Blockbuster Video. I had made the decision to take the Sandman script, which originally was much grittier, and I was going to sort of neuter it a little bit, like not so much on the gore, mm-hmm. not so much on nudity and stuff. I took out all the good stuff, which was the only failing of that movie, really. I mean, I'm glad that people, when they see it and people like it, I'm certainly happy, but it's not really the movie we initially set out to make, you know, per se. But anyways, it was a nightmare to make it, because we shot in this trailer park, which now I always tell people, never set a movie in a trailer park, because it's just the worst. You know, luckily found like this, I thought was a great location, out in Niles, Ohio, outside of Youngstown, to shoot that movie. But you know, we basically lived in that trailer park for like 3.5 weeks shooting that movie, and it was just a nightmare, because it was, you know, we later found out that it was like, you know, that's like the, there's like gang members wandering around this trailer park. It was like the real dregs of society. It was like the worst possible place we could. And I knew, you know, it's too good to be true, right? Because there's one trailer park that's willing to let us, give us, you know, these trailers for cheap and let us basically take the place over and shoot. You know, of course, there's got to be a catch to it. But that's what the catch was. It's kind of funny. But no, it was just, you know. There was a lot of drama just in general. Like I was married at that time and had, you know, basically around the time Ozone came out, we separated. So that whole year I was shooting that movie, I was separated, and there was a lot of back and forth drama. It ended amicably the next year. And so there was no problem there, but it was kind of at the height of like all this personal drama and making this movie in this trailer park. And so I think the somber tone of that movie was pretty much a result of all of that. I had a lot of very negative feelings after making that movie. I actually started drinking, not like abusively drinking, but I had never drank alcohol in my life until after I made that movie. You know, a bunch of friends and I would go out every night, you know, and I got caught up in like, you know, oh, let's drink. I have Long Island iced teas and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, that just makes you feel more miserable.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was kind of a dark, you know, coming off of the high of Ozone, I had all these grandiose ideas of things I was going to do with that movie, and it didn't quite work out the way I wanted it. But it ultimately had a happy ending because, you know, the movie turned out pretty much the way, you know, it turned out as much as the way I wanted it as it could. But I spent way too much money on it, you know, given the time. It was kind of the opposite of Ozone. I was just like, oh, I'm just going to throw money at this thing, whatever. Whatever money I have come in, you know, I was like going to my P.O. box to see what I mail orders I had that day, and whatever that money was, oh, we'll spend it. You know, I don't care. It's like, well, just, we're going to solve any problems this movie has. We're going to spend money on it. And that wasn't such a smart approach either.
See, it was funny because I was going to say, you know, there aren't enough movies, horror films, set in trailer parks.
Well, that's probably why. now I know why. And that's true. I mean, and it was. But see, originally, the original script for that movie, the writer, Gary, the character Gary, lived in the trailer park, but his girlfriend lived in a house nearby, you know, so it kind of took it out of, and that was one of the consolidation things that we did to it. We're like, well, wouldn't it be more interesting if all these characters lived in this trailer park and we just kind of contain it there? But I think that was one of the things that was a mistake ultimately. I think it would have been better if the girlfriend had lived somewhere else and you kind of have a change of scenery. But I don't know, you know, it's hard to, you can always go back and say, oh, if I could do something differently. But the Sandman's probably the one movie, because people are always asking me, would you ever do a remake of one of your movies? It's like, probably the Sandman would be the one I would remake, because that was the first one where I really felt like I was working with actors and trying to do something, and I don't think I accomplished everything that I set out to do on it, but that had the most potential that didn't quite live up to itself, I guess.
Okay. Well, and then after talking to you about Sandman, I'm almost afraid to mention the next one, but I also am a huge fan of Polymorph, which is another, I guess, sort of sci-fi horror film that you shot. And just maybe how that came about. And this one, I guess, is a little different. You shot a lot of this in the woods.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Polymorph was kind of like, okay, I had made a lot of mistakes on the Sandman, so I'm not going to do that again. I'm going to be a little more disciplined and shoot it for, you know, less money and try to, you know, cover up some of the mistakes. But Polymorph was the one that came sort of, you know, where Ozone, I had felt I had advanced a little bit, the filmmaking part of it, and the Sandman, I felt like I had worked with the actors better. Polymorph was the first one that I felt kind of brought the two together, even though, again, it's flawed. It's far from a perfect movie. But that was where I felt it started to really gel, was Polymorph. That was kind of the function of that movie, was, you know, to take something that was more character-driven and still try and do something cool with it. But that was a movie I actually didn't want to make initially. It was a story I had written years and years earlier. In fact, I had one of my Super 8 short films that I had started and never finished was called Polymorph. That's how long ago that, you know, and that was when I was probably in junior high school or something that I had done that. But that title and that concept that had always been sticking around in my head, so it was something I wanted to do for a long time, but it just kind of was languishing in a file folder. And two of the actors that had worked for me, here, Ariana Albright and James Edwards, they were, you know, they were the kind of people that were like constantly nagging me. Like the minute one movie was done, they're like, well, let's shoot another movie. We're just not alive unless we're making movies. We got to make movies all the time, make movies. And, you know, and I'm like, guys, you know, all you have to do is show up and do your thing and we shoot these things, but I got to, you know, spend months finishing this stuff and doing all this post-production work and release it and try and make some money so we can make another one. And it's like, they don't understand. But to placate them, I told Ariana, I said, just go through my, you know, all these pages and pages of ideas from my past and see if you can find something that would be interesting and then we'll talk about it. And I figured that would keep her busy for a while. Well, she narrowed it down to Polymorph. She's like, I really think this is a good idea. You should do this one. And then to placate James Edwards, who was wanting to write a script at the time, I said, okay, fine. Here's this treatment. What, you know, you got any ideas? And he did, and he threw them out at me. I said, okay, fine, go write that script. And I figured, this will keep them busy while I'm off doing other stuff, and, you know, maybe they'll just forget about it. Well, of course, that didn't happen. And long story short, they could, you know, the script wound up being something, you know, when I read it, I thought, well, this could be fun. Let's do this. So I went into it initially not wanting to make it, but I think that was sort of that attitude somehow made it easier for me I went into it without a lot of expectations on my head, I guess, or a lot of, you know, I didn't feel like, oh, I'm going to challenge myself to do something better, but I just was casually sort of making a movie. You know, I was like, this looks like this would be fun to do, and blah, 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 blah. And I cast a lot of people that I had met in the interim that I wanted to work with, and it just, everything fell together, and it was, you know, it as a result, I think that's one of the reasons that movie plays the way it does. But it's kind of an odd movie because I could tell the first half of it, people are sort of, they watch it and they're sort of like, you know, they don't know what to make of it. And somehow there's something happens in the second half of the movie that sort of catches people. It's like if people only watch 10 or 15 minutes, they won't ever get it. You know, they won't ever see it. And that's asking a lot of any movie for people to sit and hang in there. But there's something in the last half of that movie that sort of grabs people. And I've never quite figured out what it is, but by, you know, they seem satisfied after they watch it, I guess, if they can make it through the whole thing.
Yeah. I personally really get a kick out of the movie.
Well, that one you're not alone in. That one, a lot of people, I mean, I've made very little money on it. It was kind of a flop, both on VHS and DVD. But that one has sort of universally gotten the best reviews. And
really?
I find a lot of people are like, oh, I really like that. I think it's the title, you know, the box cover, both on VHS and DVD. Neither box cover was very good. It's just somehow that movie gets lost. I don't know if, you know, people like Polymorph, like, I don't understand what that movie's about or what is this. And, you know, there wasn't like a defined creature that you could slap on the cover, some really cool creature. You know, it was just a tough sell. And I just, but, you know, I was an example of making the kind of movie that I wanted to make. It was like, you know, I wasn't making it to market it or to get rich or whatever. I just made it because it was something I wanted to make. But, no, I mean, it's, you know, it does some business, but it's certainly, but one of the lesser, profiting movies of all the stuff that I've done, I would say.
So you've shot all these movies in Ohio. And then, I guess the next movie I want to talk about is you get into a franchise and end up in Romania, Bucharest?
Yeah. Witch House 2, Blood Coven.
Yeah. How'd that happen?
Well, there was, after Polymorph, we made I produced another film here called Bloodletting, which was another film that was released on Tempe that Matt Walsh, who had written The Sandman, had done. So there was one more in Ohio, and then basically at that point I felt like, you know, we had done Ozone, Sandman, Polymorph, and Bloodletting, and now I felt like, you know, kind of like stagnant, like the grass is starting to grow around my feet, and how much more can we do with these, you know, under $10,000 budgets, and, you know, how much can we do in Ohio, you know, before I wanted to expand my horizons, I wanted to work with new people, I wanted to, you know, I just wanted a different experience, I think I was bored or whatever, so I felt confident at that point that, you know, in wanting to go out to L.A., because a lot had happened in the course of between Ozone and Polymorph. You know, I had published Alternative Cinema Magazine and gotten that started and, you know, sort of oversaw it through its first 10 or 11 issues. And then it's everything just sort of came together, like, with this move to LA, because I thought, well, I'm going to take bloodletting, and I'm not going to distribute it myself. I'm going to license it to somebody else so that I get, hopefully can get a few bucks coming in, and I'm going to sell this magazine so that, you know, that I can get a few bucks off of that. And basically it was kind of this perfect storm of, it was a perfect time to move to LA because I had the financial means to do it. And I didn't have to worry about what my, you know, where my next dollar was going to come from right away. I could afford to fart around for a few months and do whatever. And I kind of just fell ass backwards into this whole thing with Full Moon Pictures as a result of it goes back to Dave Dakota from the Cinema Home Video days had hired me to edit and do the sound mix for this movie he was making for Full Moon called Shrieker. Mm-hmm. And that was really the thing that kind of got my foot in the door. And then they were so happy with the work I had done on that and certainly the price, even though for me I was making the most money I'd ever made in my life, you know, working on a movie. So for me I was like, hey, this is great. But that led to me cutting Curse of the Puppet Master, and from there it was kind of a blur. I wound up being their post-production supervisor for the next year, and were, you know, I had like a crew of like 20 people working for me that, you know, we were doing post-production and whatnot on all these movies, and that all kind of collapsed on itself by the end of 1999, I think. I was still doing work for them, but we went back to doing it sort of freelance instead of as an employee, and that kind of led back to Witch House 2 in a weird sort of way. During that time period, I had developed another script for them called Fear.com that was an idea that Charlie Band had, and that had actually gotten it written, and I think we had retitled it Horror Vision at that point. Mm-hmm. Which ultimately wound up getting made, but that was going to be the movie I was going to make for them. And I remember, you know, this day where Charlie calls me and he says, well, you know, let's you know, come down and let's talk about this Horror Vision thing, let's get this going. So I show up at his office and I sit down and we idle chit chat and whatever, and then I said, oh, so what about this Horror Vision, what do you want to do? He's like, well, you know, I was thinking, we made this movie last year called Witch House, right? And it was on the heels of this Blair Witch Project, and everybody went crazy, and we made all this money. Hollywood Video did all this huge business with it. And next thing I know, he's asking me if I want to go to Romania and make Witch House 2 instead. So I'm like, at that point, I'm just thinking, well, I guess it'd be nice to make anything, because, you know, they were still shooting stuff on 35, and, you know, I was certainly ready to do it at that point because we had worked on so many projects, so many bad projects where we, you know, it was kind of like left us to try and do the best we could, you know, and to save these movies in post-production if it was possible with, you know, some cool CGI or good titles or whatever, you know, something you can cut a good trailer out of. And so I felt like at that point, like, you know, I could make a pretty decent movie. So I said yes to it. And they pretty much left me alone. I mean, it was, you know, the script, I hired Doug Snoffer to write it, and he and I came up with the idea for it, and, you know, they didn't say, oh, it had to be this or that. There were no restrictions really placed on it. It was, so I just made it my, you know, I was able to make it my own instead of making it a Witch House 2. You know, it's Witch House 2 in name only. Mm-hmm. Other than the fact that the witch is back, but it really bears little resemblance to the first movie. But, yeah, next thing I know, I spent a month in Romania and making that thing, and that was certainly one of the better experiences of my life, although the shoot, again, was grueling. I was deathly ill the whole month I was there. It's like, you know, living in a foreign country for a month. We were in freezing locations and all kinds of stuff. But, you know, that was the one where I really felt like, hey, you know, I've arrived now. I'm a filmmaker. Like, they, you know, they put us up at the Hilton Hotel in Bucharest, and I have my own personal driver that, you know, you get in the car in the morning and they drive you off to the set and blah, blah, blah. I was like, hey, this is like the life, you know. Somebody's actually paying me a few bucks to make a movie here.
Did you cast this movie, or was it cast for you?
No, I was involved in the whole casting process. I mean, some of the choices I was overruled on by some of the kids that were cast were not necessarily people that I wanted, but for the most part, I got who I wanted. I mean, it was Andrew Prine was certainly when I heard he was available, that he could come in, because we were really having trouble with that dual role to get him in it, but he was certainly my choice. And
that's who I was going to ask you about, because as a huge fan of drive-in movies from the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
He's just like, I mean, he's a legend from the 70s. What was it like working with him?
Oh, man, he was like, you know, the first thing about him, because he comes from that kind of old school, he just totally has, like, respect for the director, even though he didn't have a clue who I was, you know, or didn't know if I could, you know, make a movie or anything. He was very respectful and did exactly what, you know, we talked through what I wanted him to do, and he just got it, you know, and especially the dual role thing. I was all nervous and worried about it, and he was like, kid, I got it. Don't worry about it. But he was totally, he was like the coolest actor probably I've ever worked with. It was just the best experience, because he was just a total pro, and there was no drama, and he was willing to do everything that we wanted him to do, and he just got the movie. For whatever reason, he read the script. He's like, yep, got it. I know exactly what to do. And he did. Cool. So, no, he was great to work with. That was a good experience.
And then I guess you did the follow-up to Witch House 2 and did Witch House 3 Demon Fire?
Well, there was sort of a gap between those, because I went off and got the bright idea to produce a bunch of stuff for Charlie, which led to doing we did Horror Vision, Stitches, The Vault, and Groom Lake between those two Witch House movies. I didn't direct any of those. I just produced them. So there was probably another year, at least a year anyways, you know, where I was off doing other stuff for them. And then Witch House 3 kind of came about as a total fluke, because he was going to pick up some other movie, that somebody had made. I can't even remember the name of it now, but it was this really not very good, you know, kind of the Craft knockoff, mm-hmm. with the girls wanting to be witches or whatever. And there were a lot of technical problems with it. I remember, he gave it to me and he said, well, tell me what you think, cause we're thinking about buying this movie and calling it Witch House 3. And I was at that point, I guess I had some sort of attachment to that, you know, having just done the second one. I was like, oh, no, you can't put this out. you can't put this out and call it Witch House 3. People are going to, they're going to be outside with torches and they're going to storm the castle. You can't do it. It's going to ruin you. And I had actually jokingly made a comment to Charlie's number two guy. I was like, well, hell, this, you know, the money you're going to spend on this thing, I could go out and make you a whole nother movie. And, you know, foolishly, he went and told Charlie that. Next thing I know, my phone's ringing, and Charlie's like, could you really make a movie for like 15 grand or whatever, or 18 grand or whatever it was? And I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, I've done, you know, did plenty of those out in Ohio. And he's like, well, would it be anything watchable? And I'm like, well, you know, it'd be better than this, better than this thing that you want to call Witch House 3. He's like, but we need it fast. We got to have it, you know, by such and such. I'm like, Charlie, don't worry about it. I said, if you want to do it, just let me know. Say the word. He's like, okay, go ahead and do it. So called up Matt Walsh, said, you know, I need a script. This is the idea I have. Three hot chicks in a beach house. You know, go. and that was probably the first time that he and I were both totally in sync. I mean, we'd done a lot of work together, and he's written a lot of scripts for me. But that one, he just got it. Except for the end, the original ending to that, he had built this huge Suspiria-esque ending that I would have never been able to pull off. Because my thing with that movie was, I've only got so much money. I want to write something so that I can pull it off well, and not have anything look really hokey or cheesy. That was my goal, anyways. But
I like it. I thought you succeeded.
Yeah, no, and I did too. I mean, that was really one of the first movies that I made where I sat down and I thought, this just kind of works. Like, you know, there's a couple moments where it's kind of genuinely suspenseful, and, you know, I enjoyed it. I mean, there's, again, they all have their own flaws, but I thought we, you know, had pulled it off pretty well. And Charlie liked it and didn't sell as well as the, again, it was the law of diminishing returns with those movies, because you got a movie called Witch House that comes out right as Blair Witch 1 is in the theaters, you know, and so everybody's into witch mania and they want to see another witchcraft movie. And, you know, Witch House 1 was not such a good movie, but people rented it. That's all that mattered. And that's how Witch House 2 got made. And Witch House 2 came out at the same time Blair Witch 2 came out. And here I was thinking, well, these sequels are kind of both improvements on the originals, which is kind of like the opposite direction from the way it usually goes. But it didn't matter because nobody saw either one of them. they both didn't do good business. And then you got Witch House 3 where you're, you know, it's just, you go from, well, last time we were in, a year ago we were in Romania, and now here we're banging this thing out in L.A. for cheap. But I thought the Witch House movies got better, you know, kind of went in the opposite direction. but the amount of money they made went in the direction you don't want it to go in. So,
what was it?
But it did okay. I mean, it's not, you know.
Well, again, I want to ask you about a couple of casts because we see three hot chicks. What was it like working with Debbie Rochon and Brink Stevens?
Well, Brink I had known for years, and we had actually cast her. I think she was in Hell Asylum before that, and we had, you know, we had been friends forever and had never done anything. And I kind of was like, didn't want to cast her in the Lilith role because it, you know, on the surface it just seems like, well, this is just, you know, we're not really giving her a lot to do. But you know, she's a trooper and she's a professional, and she said, I don't care, I'll do it, sure, you know, that sounds great, because Ariana had played the witch the first two times, and she and I had some personal drama, and we had a falling out over, you know, at the time at Witch House 3 happened, and I was kind of like, well, I guess we'll just forge ahead and we'll cast this, you know, we're going to go in a different direction with this part anyways. So you know, I called up Brink and she was willing to do it, and no, both of them were great. I mean, it was, you know, that really, there were five people in the movie, and mm-hmm. out of the five, there was a little bit of drama with one of them, but the other, you know, for the majority of that movie, it was like a perfect situation. And the ironic part of it is I walked into that movie thinking, I'm just going to make this thing. I told them, you know, I opened my mouth and I said I could do this. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it as well as I can. But I'm not even going to put my name on this movie. This is just something I'm just doing just to prove that I can, you know, hoping maybe it'll lead to bigger and better things. And by the time I was done with it, I was so happy with it that I was like, well, I'd be stupid not to put my name on this.
Cool.
But, yeah, no, I mean, the whole cast was great to deal with. That was easily one of the better experiences that I've had making a movie. It was, you know, it was every day was a lot of fun. It wasn't like a chore. It was, you know, we all had fun making it, and it just, all the pieces fell into place the right way, I guess.
Well, then I guess a couple of years later, you kind of shifted gears again away from the kind of like, I guess, straight horror film. And as a huge fan of, B movies from the 50s. I'm fascinated with how you got involved in Deadly Stingers.
Ugh. Well, see here, if you haven't noticed by now, there's a cycle where I do something I'm proud of, and then somehow along the way, I get off track. And Stingers was another one of those. Well, first of all, between Witch House 3 and Stingers, there was another bunch of things that I had produced. We went on to do, I'm drawing a blank now. Killjoy 2, which was the anti-epic that that was. Killjoy 2, Hell Asylum, and Dead and Rotting. And then I kind of, from a distance, produced two other movies called Bleed and Jigsaw. And Jigsaw I was fond of, and Bleed I wasn't so fond of. But anyways, those led me back to Stingers, Deadly Stingers. And that was supposed to be a bigger thing, okay? Charlie Band had this deal with Fox Home Video, and he was gonna get like $500,000 from them to make this movie. And of course, you know, it was gonna cost $500,000, but he wanted to make it for like $125,000. This is always the Charlie Band way. So, stupidly, I agreed. You know, I read the script, and the original script was. Could have been good. Could have been really cool, but you know, not with that kind of money. I mean, it was kind of like the aliens of giant scorpion movies, where you just got giant scorpions all over the place doing stuff that I knew there was no way we were going to do it, because Charlie was insistent on having this giant scorpion puppet, and he had already allotted this guy that he had do a lot of his effects for him. You know, this guy had done favors for Charlie before, so now he's like, I'm going to give $10,000 of your budget to this guy to make this giant scorpion puppet. And I'm like, oh boy, this is already not going to go well. And I had planned some CG shots, but only a few, because I didn't think we were going to be able to afford any more. Mm-hmm. Anyway, long story short, I wound up doing rewrites on the movie, trying to get it in the shape where I thought we could shoot it, and not a very fun experience. Trying to think of anything positive. I mean, it still hasn't come out. Nobody's seen it, so I guess it hasn't killed my career, so to speak, of my so-called career. But I mean, so it's a weird thing, because some people have seen it and said, "Oh, you know, it's fun. It's like it's harmless. It's like it's not, you know, I liked it because it was kind of a throwback to those 50s movies, you know what I mean, the giant bug movies and stuff. And to me, I watch it and I see, like, elements of Polymorph and some of my other stuff that I've done. And, I mean, I see the same kind of shtick, I guess, in some of the scenes. But it's not my favorite movie. I mean, I literally was sitting there in the online bay with doing the final titles on it, and I had another name put in as director. And I, a couple of my friends were there, and I'm looking at this thing. We're just about to lay it off the tape and deliver it and finish it. I'm like, well, what do you think? Should I go with this name, or should I just put my own name on it? Like, just put your name on it. Tell me. Like I said, nobody's really seen it except for, you know, my circle of friends. And at this point, you know, that was so many years ago now, most people have just forgotten about it. But we screened it at a couple of conventions and stuff, and it was just sort of like, it is what it is. It just, for whatever reason, Fox never put it out. You know, I still don't know what the real story is with that. But they paid for it, but it paid some bills at Full Moon for a while. But, it's not the worst thing I've ever made, but not the best either.
Okay. Well, I want to talk a little bit now about your you kind of moved into more producing and more working with Tempe. There's a couple of things you're producing. There's two titles, actually. There's one called Platoon of the Dead that I'm interested in talking about. And then you're, I guess, in pre-production on something called Invasion of the Not Quite Dead.
Well, yeah, that one's in kind of... Somebody wrote me into attaching my name to that to try and help them get that made, and that I keep trying to get that taken down off of IMDb. I'm not really involved in that one, so that one's kind of a cheat. And I actually tried deleting it off of IMDb, and it said that because of the cast and crew is confirmed, you can't edit this title. And I'm like, what? How could it be confirmed? I didn't confirm anything. Anyways, long story short, but yeah, I have nothing to do with that one. But Platoon of the Dead was. One of these cases where I've become this guy from Cinema Home Video all these years ago, because I had this title, Platoon of the Dead, for years. Anytime I would say it around my friends, they would just groan, like, ah, oh, that again. You can't make that. You know, and I never really had a story attached to it. It was just a title. It was like, Platoon of the Dead. Like, we got to make a movie someday called Platoon of the Dead. Anyways, I think this goes back to probably almost 2 years ago now. I had met John Bowker, who had made the Evil Maker films years ago, and he had moved to LA, and we used to hang out and go to lunch and stuff, and we kept in touch, and he really wanted to make something for me, and I started to get, with the more recent stuff I've been putting out, I started to get the idea, well, maybe I'll finance a few little movies a year and, you know, I'll throw out some titles or some old scripts or something to try and get some of these old projects that have been languishing around for a while to get them made. And, you know, I wouldn't necessarily be so hands-on. You know, I would just kind of job it out like people had done for me in years prior and let them, you know, make the movie, and then I'll bring it in and finish it and do some of the post-work and stuff. So that's how Platoon of the Dead started. I threw the title out to John Bowker, and John said, oh, I think I could do something with that. He was like the first person that said, I think I could do something with that. Where everybody else, like I said, my friends had all groaned and said, oh, you can't do anything with that. And, you know, he sent me the script, and I read it, and I thought, yeah, this is fine. Let's do this. So he, you know, took the few bucks that I gave him and ran off and made it. And it languished for a while because we had some post-production problems with it. He had shot it actually in HD, and something had happened in the editing, and it didn't we had to go back, and I had to go back and redo it, and then get it to in a position where he could do the sound work on it. So it kind of sat longer than I wanted it to, but it was probably a better thing because I originally intended to put it out last year, and last year was sort of a horrible, horrible year as far as the DVD business went. Mm-hmm. And so I finally finished it up the end of last year, beginning of this year, and announced it and got it out. And it, you know, it's got some really, really horrible reviews on YouTube and Netflix. Like, people just hate it. But I'm ashamed to say it, but I actually made a few bucks on it. So I don't know what else to say. It's like, I should be ashamed of myself. But, you know, I mean, it's like, I kind of feel the same way. I mean, no slight to John, because John worked his butt off on it, and he did the best job he could for the meager money that I gave him. But it's not the worst thing I've had my name attached to. It's not the best thing I've ever had my name attached to. It falls somewhere in the middle. But it has moments of fun, and, you know, some people like it, some people don't. I learned a long time ago, you know, you make this stuff, and especially if you've made more than a couple of movies over the span of as many years as I've been doing this stuff, you're not gonna win the hearts of everyone. It's just impossible to even try. You know, some people love the Humanoids from Atlantis, that, you know, worst movie, the thing I think is the worst thing I've done, or Robot Ninja or whatever, and you know, I look at it and I'm just like, oh my God, I'd rather die than anybody ever see that.
So that leads me to my next question.
Okay.
What's your favorite movie that you've ever made?
Well, I can't narrow it down to one. Okay. I will tell you it would not be Dead Next Door, just because I can't see past the flaws. I know that's the one that everybody sort of the universe would probably agree is the best movie I've done, and I've read stuff online where people are like, oh, this guy made Dead Next Door, and then what the hell happened to him after that? He made a bunch of junk or whatever. It's like, well, again, can't please everybody. But my personal favorite, I would probably have to go with Witch House 2 or 3.
Cool.
But not to slight the other ones, I would also lump probably Polymorph in there somewhere too. And, of course, Ozone, just because Ozone was more of a personal triumph. So I can't – people ask me to narrow it down to one. I can't do it. So, but there's a handful.
Okay. And you've kind of like moved more into running Tempe. And is it interesting to be on the other side now, being a distributor and working with filmmakers? And like you said, you were able to give somebody some of these titles, and then also putting some of these other movies out. Is it interesting being on the other side?
Yeah, because, you know, I think by the time I had made Deadly Stingers a few years ago, I had burned myself out of actually making movies and being so hands-on. I had just had so many rotten experiences. I mean, it's funny because that whole Full Moon era was like, it's like the saying go, the best of times, the worst of times. It was equal both, because nobody should ever complain that you get so many opportunities to make movies, and I certainly don't. And they, all the budgets, any of those movies, were pretty much bigger budgets than most of the stuff that I had done back here. And I accomplished way more than I ever thought that I would do when I first moved to California. So I'm not looking a gift horse in the mouth in any respect. But at the same time, I made a lot of stuff that I wouldn't necessarily have made if it had been up to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's like when you're making movies for a company that has a release schedule, and they have to release so many movies, and they have their own agenda, and they want to make movies like Killjoy 2 because Blockbuster and Hollywood Video are saying, you know, make a sequel to that movie, you know, because that movie sold and we could make some money on the second one. You know, the decisions are being made in a different way than when when I look back at how I made something like Dead Next Door or you know, Ozone or some of these movies where you make the decision to initiate the project, and it's your heart and soul and your energy and that goes into it or whatever. I mean, it's the same applies indirectly. I'm answering your question, even though it doesn't sound like it, but that's kind of how it is now, because now I'm trying to ride the line between other people's dreams and my, you know, what I need to do. Cause I'm the guy that's got the release schedule that I have to fill. And, I try to be a little more discriminating, but, you know, I'd be lying if I said that I think everything that I've put out on DVD is great, because it's far from it. You know, there's certainly some turkeys in there. But you know, it's one of those things that kind of goes back to the magazine business when I was doing alternative cinema years ago. It's like, if you don't put out a next issue, you don't get paid for the previous issue.
From Suspiria.
Help me!
You can hide from Suspiria.
Who's there? Who's there?
But you cannot escape Suspiria. Once you've seen Suspiria, you will never again feel safe in the dark. Rated R. Under 17, not admitted without parent.
Nature of this program, listener discretion is advised. Choose from Chainsaw Dismemberment, Nightmare 8, Satisfy your sickest fantasies.
It's a trick. Get an axe.
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
Every town has an Elvis.
No more room in hell. The dead will walk here.
We all go a little mad sometimes. Haven't you?
Destroy the Brain, St. Louis's only horror and cult movie podcast since 2007. Visit us at destroythebrainonline.com.
I tell you, that was a great interview. I had a blast interviewing J.R. Bookwalter. Thank him for spending so much time talking to us. You guys will probably notice a couple of edits. I had some computer technical difficulties. I'm not going to blame my computer. I live out in the middle of nowhere. My cable company's crap, so they kept kicking me out. I kept losing my cable modem. But J.R. was super patient with me and just was laughing about it the whole time. So he's a great guy. and the other thing is he will be at Cinema Wasteland here in October in beautiful Northeast Ohio. So if you guys are anywhere near Cinema Wasteland, you got to go and check out J.R. Bookwalter. So and I also want to thank you, Jason. You helped get this interview arranged. And I really appreciate it. This is Jason pulling some strings and chatting to some peeps, because you've known JR for a little while, haven't you?
Yeah, I've known JR probably for, I guess, a year or a little longer now. And we just kind of hit it off and talking through email and chatting and stuff. And then one thing led to another. Then we ran into each other at Wasteland last October, I think, actually. And him and I just, like, hung out quite a bit talking, and he was just such a nice guy. And he was really friendly, and this he's one of those few guys out there who does the rounds of conventions every once in a while. He doesn't do a lot of them because that's not his main source of income. He just does it just to do it, get out of the house, it seems like. And he's so fan friendly. He's one of those guys that's like, if you buy my thing, I sign for free.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that there's very few people out there who does stuff like that. You know, they're all about the money. They're all about that, you know. And JR's just like, you know, he had this whole huge, you know, set up for his Tempe home video. And he signed stuff for free, pictures for free. Just, you know, he's a wealth of knowledge. And, you know, there's very few guys out there, unfortunately, nowadays that still do those kind of things. And he's one of those last guys that still does that.
Yep. He's a heck of a guy,
And he's just genuinely nice. He's not, like, being nice to try to, like, sell stuff. I mean, you know, of course he wants to sell things. I mean, you know, he likes to make a little bit of money. Who doesn't? But he's genuinely interested in you. That's the thing. He wants to talk. So that's the other thing about JR. When you talk to JR, and I definitely suggest, because this show will be out before Wasteland. Mm-hmm. So when you all listen to when you all go to Wasteland, go see JR. Talk to the guy. He's a class act, and you will not be disappointed. He's a really nice man, so.
Yes, he is. So, with that in mind, we're going to talk a little bit about J.R. Bookwalter's first film. And if you've listened to the interview, you know that that would be his little zombie epic, his little zombie opus, funded and coordinated and assisted with the master Schillender himself. which, you know, we'll talk about that here in a bit. It is The Dead Next Door. So, excuse me, guys. I'm just going to warn everybody right now as I launch into this plot that I have my allergies are killing me. So if my voice is a little weak, sorry, guys, but it is what it is. A brief plot summary for The Dead Next Door. You got zombies. The zombies, there's an epidemic, and zombies, the dead have risen, and they're running around. The government has created this, well, okay, the movie basically opens up in a world overrun with zombies. Mm-hmm. The government has set up the squad of zombie killers to go and find a cure for this zombie plague. And like he had mentioned in the interview, it's not your traditional zombie plague. It's kind of like he was sort of inspired by the whole AIDS thing and the idea of a virus. So shooting him in the head doesn't put him down, that kind of thing. so this group of zombie hunters are out trying to find a cure and trying to take care of some zombies. And they run into – and, of course, the movie shot in Ohio, a bunch of it. So they run into this crazy cult of whack jobs in Ohio that – are zombie lovers, and they want to preserve the zombies, and you know, it's like a new world of zombie love and crap like that. It's God's will, and I'm interested to talk to you about your ideas or how you feel about some of the religious overtones in this movie. But then one of the members of the zombie squad gets infected, and then of course that prompts the rest of them to really go out and try to find the cure before their friend becomes a zombie, which is, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. And basically, most of the movie boils down to them trying not to get killed by the zombies and not to get killed by the crazy cultists who are the crazy religious people, crazy culty people who are keeping zombies and are also trying to protect them. So, you know, basically, if you're like a religious person who believes like the zombies are the new world and they're the will of God, when a bunch of people show up and try to destroy the zombies or cure the will of God, it kind of gets you bent out of shape. And that's pretty much the plot. I don't want to give any spoilers away. You know, dude, for me, this is a pretty good zombie movie, and definitely a very good independent zombie movie. What do you think?
Yeah, I really enjoy it. I mean, as far as being shot on Super 8, and like I was telling you before, you know, I think off camera or whatever, off microphone, that I wasn't really a big fan of stuff shot on Super 8 or like kind of like that low budget stuff. But when I watched JR's movie, it didn't feel like that. It didn't look like that. It was pretty shocking, actually.
Well,
and I couldn't believe it. And so I was like, wow, this is pretty cool. And,
I mean, you know, a lot of people just really crap on this movie. And I know it's got it doesn't have the great, I mean, there's a lot of fans of this movie, and I'm one of them. But there's a lot of people that crap on the movie because it is shot not on 35. And it does, to be honest, it does look a little. It doesn't look like a big budget movie. It's not a big budget movie. I also know people rip on the dubbing quite a bit because it's dubbed, and some of the dubbing is not great. But you know, I think the most distracting part is who did the dubbing, and we'll talk about that a little later on because there's one recognizable voice right away to horror fans. But you know, I'm with you on this. I mean, you know, I'm not completely with you on this. I should say I am a fan of a lot of low-budget stuff, and you know that. I watch a lot of shot on VHS stuff, and I mean, I watch a lot of things that perhaps kind of bug you and a lot of other audiences because it is shot rather cheaply. But I thought I am with you on the fact that this doesn't really feel, for what he had to work with and what he was shooting on, it doesn't feel that like a poorly shot, low-budget movie on again, I think it was pretty sure Super 8. I know it wasn't VHS yet. That was later on in his career. The lighting, the camera work, it looks pretty decent. It looks, I mean, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say it looks like an Argento movie, and it's beautiful, and it's gorgeous, because it's not perfect, but damn it, for a low-budget zombie movie shot in the 80s, it's pretty damn good.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was getting at. I mean, I was just blown away by the way it looked, quite frankly, because, you know, I'm not a huge fan of, you know, that lower budget looking V8, you know, films, and I was so shocked at how well it did look and the performances he got out of it and everything. I mean, just the performances, the camera work, like you said, the lighting, you know, all the effects and everything. I mean, you know, it was really well done. I think that goes back to what kind of filmmaker JR is in general because of, you know, him being able to pull all that together with the budget that he had.
J.R. Bookwalter's movies are a lot, especially the stuff shot on VHS later on, they get a lot of, again, I'm going to go back and say the word crap, they get a lot of crap from fans, and people don't like them, or they bitch and moan about them. But having seen the sheer volume of low-budget movies and independent films that I've seen, you know, something like The Dead Next Door stands out, because, again, like you say, I feel like, at least with the camera work, he definitely got – he had an eye for it, and he knew what he was doing, and he shot that stuff. It looked so much better than it had any right of turning out. I will beg to differ on you. I don't really think the performances in the movie are – I mean, to be real honest, when I think of the –
Well, I mean, for people who aren't actors, I mean
– Well, some of them were actors, and some of them weren't, but I find most of the performances to be rather cheesy. But to me, that's part of the movie's charm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I see what you're saying, but I mean, for me, again, it goes back to, you know, the way I looked at this film, and maybe you and Jared talked about this or whatever more, but I mean, to me, it looked like you have a guy with his, not really with like his, necessarily his buddies, but I mean, just people that like got together in Ohio and shot this movie, you know?
Well, these were people wasn't, who were cast, dude.
Yeah. Huh?
My impression is these are actually professional actors, a lot of them.
Oh, see, then that, I guess I would agree with what you said, because I thought these were like hanging out.
Well, some of them were locals, but these are people they did casting calls on. I don't think these are like his cousin or his neighbors or stuff.
Oh, wow. Well, then I guess, yeah, then I would go back to agree with what you're saying then, as the acting wasn't that great.
And that was my understanding from what my research and what I talked to JR about, but again, I'm not going to rip on the acting, because again, it's a cheesy kind of feel to it. There's a charm to this movie. There's kind of a passion to this movie that, again, for me, it just sort of like I'm watching it going, this is better than I ever thought it was should have been. To me, that shows somewhere in the mix there's somebody who has some exceptional talent. And in my opinion, it's J.R. Bookwalter.
Yeah, I agree. I can agree with that 100%. That's definitely for sure.
I also like the idea, and we talked a little bit about this a little bit in the interview, that he wanted to – there were some things about the Romero universe. He'll flat out say he was like he's making an homage. Or he had some other turn of phrase. I used homage. But he basically said lovingly ripping off a lot of the Romero stuff. But he actually focused on some – I thought interesting things like the idea with the virus, which, you know, if you think about it now, has been, I mean, how many infected movies do we have now? You know what I mean? So it's kind of like he was doing this in the mid 80s with the zombie film, and he was interested in a lot of the different things. Like, it was funny. He's like, you know, the Romero's films are claustrophobic, and he was more interested in the rednecks that were running around shooting. That's what he was interested in, those characters and what they were doing and the things you got glimpses of in the Romero films. And I think he does a pretty good job of exploring it and bringing that out in the open. And again, I don't want to overanalyze the movie, because again, it's fairly straightforward. It really is a zombie movie. There are some interesting ideas in it, but in the end, it's a zombie film, low-budget zombie film that he's shooting and he's having a good time with in it. But I was interested in the idea of like people... Like, he takes that idea, you know, at the beginning of Dawn of the Dead, where you have the people that are protecting the zombies that were their loved ones.
Right.
He really takes that concept or that idea and kind of runs with it and, like, you know, explores, like, what is in these people's minds? What would motivate them to do that? And now, I'm not trying to put you on the spot or pick on you or anything, but, you know, most people know that you're a Christian and you're a religious dude. What's your take on that? Well, I'm seriously, but I'm really when I was watching, I'm like, you know, I wonder how Jason watches this movie, or not how you watch it, but what's in your mind or what you take away from it that might be different than another fan, because you know, there's I don't think he's bashing on religion at all. I just think he's got this interesting thing where the people, like, it's kind of a culty religion thing, and again, I just was interested in what your take on it would be.
I never really had a problem with it. To me, when I watched the film and when I looked at it, I didn't feel like he was making some kind of statement necessarily with it. I don't know. I just felt like, to me, it was just maybe a plot device or something to get you to look at it from a different perspective, maybe. And I don't know. Like, when I watch, I just don't know. Like, when I watched it from a personal perspective, I was kind of like, you know, how would I look at that? And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't really, you know, to be honest, I guess I didn't really put too much thought into it. I mean, when I watched it, you know, I don't know. What were you thinking? What did you think about it, for instance? Well, I mean, how did you
view it? You know, when I was watching it, I think he walked a really cool fine line there where he wasn't making any judgments or anything. And that's the
right
part. Like, even the people that are – there's one character, the leader of, like, the cult that I think really comes
right
off as – pardon my language, but I think comes off completely batshit crazy.
Yeah.
But even that character who's completely nutsoid, you can almost in such a screwed up world where, like, there's zombies walking around. Even that kind of, he's supposed to be the villain. You're kind of like, well, yeah, this guy's completely lost his marbles, but I can see why.
I mean, I felt like when JR did that character and did like that, I felt like it was like a little bit like a Jim Jones kind of thing.
You know,
where like you have this like cultic personality.
I thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, like, that to me is what it felt like. You know, you have like a Jim Jones type of person, you know, David Koresh. I mean, you know, this is before David Koresh, but I mean, you have that kind of like, you know, person who claims to be the Messiah, you know, kind of, you know, religiously or whatever. And you have people who just like don't ask questions, following the guy blindly, which is what you had Jim Jonestown. And which Jim Jones, I think that when I watched the movie, I could definitely see that. And I could definitely see people almost the zombies following this guy around without even, you know, questioning what this guy's doing and, like, you know, carrying out his murders and, you know, and, like, trying to keep, you know, their way of life together and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, and that's pretty much what Jones did. I mean, you know, if you disagreed with him, you got killed, you stuck together, everybody was a family and all that. So, I mean, I don't know if, you know, JR was going necessarily for that specifically, or if it was just kind of like a subconscious thing, like that's kind of like what it is, like his take on, you know, cults and Christian cults in particular.
Yeah.
But I mean, for me personally, that's kind of what I took away from it. So I guess, yeah, now that I heard you mention it, that kind of jogged my memory a little bit more, be like, ah, yeah, that's kind of where I went with that.
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm saying? Or,
yeah, absolutely. And you know, for me, and again, I want to backtrack and make something very clear to everyone. Sometimes I get occasional feedback that when we do these shows, whether it's you or I or Ed and I, that occasionally we're overanalyzing things. I'm not overanalyzing the movie. I know that JR was making just trying to make a zombie movie, and he was shooting it, and there's tons of gore and stuff like that, and we'll talk about that later. But I always think the best horror movies have some subplot, have some depth to them. Mm-hmm. They're not shallow. I mean, some of them can be fun to watch and shallow, but this one actually has some depth and subplot to it. And even though it's a cheap movie and not a big budget flick or something like that, there's more to this than I think just the surface stuff. And I really do think there's some of this, and it mean or not. And I actually kind of think that there was a lot of thought put into the, after talking to J.R. Buchwalter and what he was thinking about, there's a lot of thought put into the script here. And, you know, I kind of – what you're saying, I totally agree with it. And I don't know. I just think that it's – there's so many interesting – basically, you have – let's put this in perspective. I think he was probably 20, maybe 20, right, 21 years old when he started the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You have a guy that young who not only is going to write a script, but he's going to run out and shoot the movie, and he's telling a story, and it could have so easily been a direct ripoff. You know what I mean? How many zombie movies do we find where somebody's trapped in a house?
Right.
That's what somebody without any imagination, in my opinion, and some of those are good, and I'm not trying to rip on anybody, but if you don't have any imagination, that's a direct ripoff of like Night of the Living Dead. All
right,
that's a direct ripoff of these movies where you put them in an isolated situation. You make a Romero zombie movie. He didn't do that. He told his own story.
All right.
So I agree with that. And I, you know, my thing is really listening to these idiots talking about this low budget movie shot in the 80s on Super 8 and putting all this context into it. But you know what, guys? I think there is context to it.
Yeah. And I mean, it goes back to what you first initially asked me. Like you said, you know, does it cause you to think about it a little bit, you know, like, you know, about the whole religious perspective of it and stuff. And I mean, for me, you know, at first I was kind of like, no, but then, you know, now that I think about it, actually, yeah, I can kind of see that, you know, and I think, you know, it does, you know, I think he did take some time to actually say, you know, what do I want the story to be? You know, and I think that he successfully did that. And I, like I said, you know, it's definitely not a ripoff. I think it's definitely like it's kind of his own thing. And if anybody, I would challenge anybody to watch it and, you know, and think and say and think anything different, because I think it really is his vision, his idea, and not just a blatant ripoff, which could, like you said, could have been just so easy to do. And he actually deferred to it. And I think that's what we have with The Dead Next Door for sure.
Yeah. So I guess the other part of The Dead Next Door that I wanted to cover before we went, and is for now, you know, we're talking about all the subtext, and I think there's a pretty in-depth plot and some interesting ideas. And this is again why I also always have the interview first before we talk about the movie that may, perhaps I talked to the filmmaker about, is because he goes. I mean, if you hear JR talk about the movie, you realize he put some thought into it. So we're not just blowing smoke out our butts here. You know, at the same time, what another thing that, and initially when I first watched the movie, the thing that grabbed me, well, there's two things. Number one, I'm not going to lie, guys. I'm from Ohio. I'm actually about 25 minutes, 30 minutes away from Akron. If you listen to the interview, you realize that's where he started out at. He shot the stuff in Akron, Ohio. So I was in college when I was just right in college when the movie came out, and so I was an Ohio guy living right near Akron, and here's a guy shooting zombie movies in Akron, so that got my attention. But the other thing that grabbed my attention, and I want to see what you think, is for a low budget movie, I was really impressed with the gore. I thought it was decent.
Oh yeah, I mean that's what I think I said in the first thing when I kind of described it was like definitely the gore. I mean I was, you know, I didn't know what to expect when I was watching the movie. You know, as a 30-year-old adult when I watched it like a couple years ago, and I got it back in my hands and got the Anchor Bay release, and I was like, wow, the gore is done really well. It was really good.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, you know, who did this gore, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, Ohio. Mm. So, I mean, I was impressed for sure. I agree.
Yeah, I just think that, you know, along with the story and everything else we've talked about, he actually delivered a movie, a low-budget zombie movie that has some decently executed gore. It's a very sticky film. Does some of it look fake? Sure, some of it looks fake. But you know what? Who cares? Yeah. It's a low-budget zombie movie. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've seen a ton of low-budget zombie films, okay? This has got to be easily in the top five of you know, especially from the 80s and 90s. This is a great, great little movie. It's got gore, it's got plot, it's got everything I want in a zombie film. And the other thing that I want to say to everybody, is you have to watch this movie and appreciate it, because again, he talks a little bit about this in the interview that I conducted. But when they were shooting this, they didn't have. I mean, you know, guys now can go shoot some really beautiful looking movies on digital, and he didn't have that technology. So a lot of people look at the movie now and go, you know, 20 some years later, well, that doesn't look well, dude. Considering this is even before they had. You know, people bitch and moan about trying to edit on deck to deck with VHS. You have no clue, dude. He didn't even have that. This is actually Super 8, and it's not easy to deal with.
No, and I just want to back up this for a second too, and say, you know, about the gags for the, and the gore gags and everything. Is that I would take his dated gore gags that some of them might not come off even that great now, but most of them I thought did. But, you know, there's a couple, like you said, there's a couple spots on there that you're kind of like, eh. But I would still take those over the crappy Romero versions recently of the CGI that's so just terrible looking,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I'm like, you know.
The double whammy.
So I'm like,
Pardon?
Right. You know, I'm just saying, like, you know, in Land of the Dead, where I got the priest zombie neck thing or whatever. Like, I'd rather see, for me though,
when you say that though, the thing that's a slap in the face to me, it's like a double slap, is when they do the really bad CGI on the Greg Nicotero zombie.
Yeah. Well, of course. I mean, those are the kind of things. I mean, you know, at least, you know, I mean, when I look at it, at least I'm looking at something that's real.
Yeah.
The Dead Next Door stuff, you know, when JR is shooting that stuff. At least it's real. It's in camera. And, yeah, maybe it doesn't look, you know, as realistic as some other movies at that time did. But, I mean, at least it's something that was tangible.
Exactly.
Whereas now so many film directors are like, oh, we'll just take care of that in post. We'll just fix that up later. And, yeah. You know, and even people like, you know, the big granddaddies like Romero and them have gotten lazy when it comes to those kind of things. I'm just like saying, you know, yeah, people might make some fun of some of the effects, but I'd rather take JR's effects in that movie over a lot of the effects nowadays being put out there by these same guys that are using CGI as an easy way out.
And especially the sheer volume of effects and the quality of effects work in a movie like Dead Next Door, it exceeds anything you're going to get in a low-budget zombie movie now.
Oh, yeah, totally. So I just wanted to throw that in there. So.
I guess there's a couple more things I want to mention. Just to let you guys know, I'm not even going to mention it. If you want to know who the Master Shellender is and you want to know who did the dubbing, it's not going to be hard to find. And that way you can track it down and show some interest. But there were some people that were, shall we say, a crew from Detroit actually assisted J.R. Buchwalter in getting the movie made. And they are very familiar to horror fans. So I thought that was kind of a cool connection, too, as well.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, you could say it has something to do with the Drag Me to Ohio.
Yeah.
So.
Hey, now.
Ohio, hey, now. Watch out.
Could be worse. Could be Drag Me to Kentucky.
Yeah. But the one thing kind of on that note I wanted to say, which is kind of like a little interesting tidbit, which I noticed when I first watched it, when I watched it years ago when I was a kid, I didn't really pick up on these things. But when I watched it again as an adult, I thought it was cool because JR uses lots of people that he knows and respects names in the movie. So you'll people like Captain Carpenter and Sergeant Romero or Mr. Savini or something like that. I mean, I might be making up the prefixes or something, but they're using those names in the movie, and I think that's really cool. You know,
it just
gives like a little wink and a nod to the audience who is in the know.
I know.
So I thought that's kind of neat.
That kind of adds to the cheese factor too, which you know, the movie actually has some interesting plot to it. It's got some context. It's got good gore, and at the same time, it manages to be really cheesy at points, which. I don't, and personally, I don't know how you feel, but I love cheesy movies if they're entertaining. And this one's entertaining and cheesy at times. So for all of you arrogant snot bags that want to crap on this movie on IMDb, get over yourselves. It is what it is, and it is a classic.
It
of
is
the low budget, cheapy genre.
Yeah, JR is a master, man.
Yeah,
I loved it. So that's for sure.
So, I did too. I recommend it. It's fairly cheap from Anchor Bay, I think.
Yeah. It's even cheaper if you get it from JR in a couple weeks at Wasteland.
Just you make sure to leave me a copy and you guys going to, because JR's bringing me a copy. I'm actually replacing the VHS tape that I watched for the review.
Oh,
I'm going to buy a copy of the DVD off of JR.
There you go.
At the convention. And you know, and hey guys, and here's the truth. You like the movie, Jason, and I like the movie. Perhaps is there a chance that our opinions are colored by the fact that we're both personal fans of JR and think he's a cool dude? Absolutely, that could be the case. I don't think so. I think it is a good movie, but I'll put it out there as being completely reasonable about it. Sure, our opinions might be colored a little bit one way or the other, but I think this is worth checking out.
Oh, I definitely think it's worth checking out. I mean, of all the crap that comes out nowadays, the direct-to-DVD stuff that's, like, you know, made by some, like, Yugoslavian and, like, Brussels that comes out and people are like, oh, it's pretty good, man. It's brutal. You know, and it's just all this is gore for gore's sake. And then you put that up against, you know, JR's actual well-thought-out, put-together movie. I would take JR's stuff. Even if I didn't know him as a person, I'm just sticking it up against, you know, some kind of crappy, you know, David Carradine, Michael Madsen joint that they made in Thailand for, like, you know, just so they can make a paycheck.
Don't crap on
you know, CGI show. Fest. You know what I'm saying, though. Some crappy CGI fest with, like, no-name actors, and then you got, like, you got Madsen showing up with a shotgun in it. You know, I'd rather sit down and watch JR's movie any day of the week compared to that kind of stuff. So, you know, if you're going to watch that kind of goofy stuff, then I definitely ask you to give JR's The Dead Next Door a chance, because I think you won't be disappointed.
I agree. So I think we've done that one to death. Why don't we take a quick break, unless you have anything else to add?
Nope. I'm ready to rock and roll, hoochie-coo.
We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about America's only patriotic, slashing, serial killer, maniac, dead guy. Uncle Sam!
Yeah!
Yeah, it's Uncle Sam!
Uncle Sam, go get him, Uncle Sam!
He's going to kick everybody's butts. You're an enemy of America, you're going down.
He's going to open up a can of Desert Storm on you.
Yeah. All right, we'll be back right after this on the Gut Munchers Podcast.
From the creator of Halloween and the star of The Exorcist, Linda Blair in Hell Night. Garth Manor, where the unseen, the unspeakable, hides its terror in cobwebbed corridors. Linda Blair, Vincent Van Patten, and Peter Barton in Hell Night. From Compass International, rated R, under 17, not admitted without parent.
Yeah, is it recording now?
Yeah, it's recording. okay, sorry, great. Guys. We had, I'm telling you, it was pure brilliance. Jason had never done anything better on this podcast than the 3 or 4 minutes of audio that he was just tearing through. It was incredible. It was like classic, and I didn't hit the record button.
Exactly. So now it's just never going to ever be aired on a radio or podcast.
It's lost forever.
It's lost. It's going to be in the vault. Hold on, wait. No, it won't. It was never recorded to be in the vault.
Yeah, it was never recorded. Only you and I will ever know how good you just were.
I know. Now I'm going to screw it all up, so we'll be ready to go.
But we're going to talk a little bit about a movie that, you know, we talked somewhat about this kind of thing with Dead Next Door, where, you know, it's a silly – Dead Next Door is just a – it's more than just a zombie movie. There's some context to the story and some meat to the story.
Right.
And we're going to talk about another one that – I think it's a cheesy, goofy, silly monster movie, creature feature, slasher film kind of thing, with some interesting subcontext to it. It's a little more deeper than you would just imagine that a goofy movie like this should be, and that is the Bill Lustig directed Uncle Sam.
All right, and the reason why you're going to get a movie with some interesting subtext and a little bit thicker than your normal paper-thin plots is because Larry Conan wrote this. And he's known to write politically driven scripts, or at least social commentary scripts a lot of times, that he has his ideas and viewpoints. And so go ahead.
Well, Larry, you mentioned that. Larry Conan, didn't he do God Told Me to Kill?
Yes. Yeah. And he did Bone, which is another one
Told Me to Kill?
I've never seen it. I mean, I know what it is, but I've never sat down and watched it.
When you say movies lots of context and politics and stuff, that jumped into my mind because that's again, it plays like an exploitation movie, but it's got depth to it. So, but anyway,
oh, yeah.
We're talking about
Definitely. Right. And I mean, that's what I'm saying because, you know, with Larry Conan, that's the kind of stuff that normally when he writes it, he usually directs it, and that's kind of his viewpoint. And I know William Lessing directed this one, but he's definitely into that type of, you know, of cinema. He actually where he wants to, like, make a point with his stuff.
Except for Serpent.
Well, that's true, too, yeah. But, I mean, a lot of his stuff has been like that, if you go back and look at his thing. I mean, he definitely dabbles in the political and social commentary scripts and stuff like that to direct. So that being said, we have Uncle Sam, and Uncle Sam is actually Sam Harper. He's a Desert Storm soldier who gets killed in the first Gulf War because of friendly fire. Well, on 4th of July, somehow he ends back up in America, resurrected, and gets sent back home. They found his body, and so they sent him back home, but he's very pissed off because he was this very patriotic soldier, and he comes back to America, and as I guess his ghost self looks around and realizes how many people are unpatriotic, it brings him from the dead to kill anybody who does not pay proper respect to America. So you have anybody who, like, you know, burns the American flag gets killed. You have anybody who's not patriotic that doesn't want to sing the national anthem in the right way will be killed, and anybody who, like, kind of, like, you know, thumbs their nose at the government in any way, shape, or form, or America will be dispatched of.
Crooked politicians, bad soldiers
who have other agendas that are like looking to score with the dead Uncle Sam's wife or sister ends up dead. So anybody who at all disrespects or disgraces himself as an American could end up being a shish kebab. And so with all this, his nephew, who really looks up to his Uncle Sam and thinks Uncle Sam's great and all this kind of stuff. And so the very first part of the whole movie, even though his Uncle Sam is going around killing people, his nephew's pretty much like, they deserve it! They deserve it! Because they're not patriotic like Uncle Sam! And so you have all that going on. And then as the story unfolds, you realize that the Sam Harper Uncle Sam guy is actually some crazy psycho who used to beat and attack his own family and his wife and beat them and all this stuff. And he actually is a real son of a gun, and he's not this, like, real patriotic guy. He just uses that as an opportunity to kill people. And so that's pretty much it. It's not too deep as far as just the surface stuff. But what I think is interesting, and I want to ask you, John, is that this movie was made in 97, so it was probably written a few years before, and then, you know, it was finally got together in 97, if I'm not mistaken. It was in 97 it was released. And so, you know, Larry Conan was writing it, and William Lessing was directing it from the mindset of the first Gulf War. Now, if you go back and watch it, I think this movie is even more relevant to what's going on now. And, you know, I think most people know our political viewpoints, or at least our, like, some of our more tendencies, at least mine necessarily, and views on things. And I really, really like this movie. And I mean, even though it's really a slap in the face necessarily and kind of like how I view things, it's a really well done as far as just like the social commentary of it. And it's, if you look through it through 2009, sunglasses, you know, and it's way more relevant than it was in 97. And a lot of the things that were said and done in the movie, even though it's almost kind of like done in tongue in cheek, is definitely kind of coming to fruition now, or had in the past, in the more recent past. So what do you think about it? You know, since you just watched it as well, I mean, wouldn't you think that's kind of true? I mean, with some of the things that were said and done in that film?
Uncle Sam seems like the kind of movie, and I like these kinds of movies because, personally, I feel like it skewers both sides.
Yes,
And it basically says you're all nuts. Mm-hmm. When you have characters that are absolute creeps. You have Timothy Bottoms plays this uber hippie. I ran off to Canada, and he's a creep. And Uncle Sam kills him, and you want Uncle Sam to die because he's an asshole, and he's unpatriotic, and he attacks the national anthem or the national anthem, and you know, but at the same time, the Uncle Sam character, who's the uber patriotic guy, really wasn't patriotic at all. He was a psychotic killer. And right. I love the Isaac Hayes character in this movie because he's the voice of reason that says, you know, and I think something along the lines of, you know, in a war, there are no heroes. There are sane people who duck their head and try to live, and then the crazy psycho killer who runs around the battlefield, and if he's lucky enough not to get killed, becomes a hero.
Right.
And the Sam Harper character is running around just whacking people. Apparently in real life he was a creep, you know, and then when he comes back as a zombie, through the they kind of hint maybe it's the hero worship of his nephew.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
And but when he comes back and starts killing people, initially it's kind of interesting. It's kind of funny because he's killing the people who are disrespectful. But then he just starts killing people that are in his way. Like, you know, when he kills the cop character that's going after his wife, that's just him being possessive. And then, of course, his sister and his wife are terrified of him.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, I think it's actually a really fun movie as far as, you know, people getting hacked to pieces can be fun, but I think that, you know, the acting in the movie is interesting, to say the least. You have an interesting cast. You have Isaac Hayes, you mentioned, which plays like probably the one of the better characters I've seen him play, actually, and I like his character. He has like this big monologue or, you know, thing that he does, talking to the nephew, trying to explain to him about how, you know, his uncle's really a crazy psycho and was a terrible guy.
Yeah.
And he was trying to lead him on the right path, but he didn't really do it. You know, he wasn't really as forceful as he needed to be. And he felt like it was his fault for turning him into this like crazy psycho killer kind of before he went off to war. And he's trying to tell that to the nephew, and the nephew's like, "You just don't really love my uncle, and you're just jealous and all this stuff." And, you know, he doesn't want to listen to what Sir Isaac Hayes has to say until later on in the film. And then you also have, like, Bo Hopkins shows up in this.
Bo Hopkins has a small and part in it.
Timothy Buttons, I think, is in this. Bottoms, yeah.
P.J. Souls has a small part.
Robert Forster, right?
Yeah.
As the crooked politician.
Yeah, William Smith shows up too for a brief period.
And PJ Souls, I was gonna say PJ Souls, and I was gonna say they have a lot of interesting, genre cred with the guys that pop up in this.
Yeah, to be honest though, they're more glorified cameos. I mean, they're not Rob Zombie bad, but they're just glorified cameos.
Yeah, they're not Rob Zombie bad. I mean, they actually show up and do some stuff though.
A little.
Except
bit.
Robert Forster doesn't really, but Robert I think Ford Isaac Hayes does. Though. Huh?
Isaac Hayes is a major character. I said, with the exception of Isaac Hayes, the rest of them are glorified extras.
Right, yeah, that's true. But I think what they do is fine.
I do have, and these aren't really issues, but I do want to say, it's kind of, the movie's really goofy. I actually personally think the first part of the movie, until Uncle Sam actually gets up and gets around and starts killing people, is really kind of slow.
Right, yeah, it is.
First 20 minutes or so is slow. And then Uncle Sam shows up and starts whacking people. Some of the kills are interesting and fun. None of them are particularly, I don't say, bloody gory. You know, there's a severed head that looks pretty fake. But it's all played tongue-in-cheek, so the effects work for me. I do love the Uncle Sam character, and 'cause he's not trying to make jokes about stuff. He's a burned up, crazy zombie soldier inside of an Uncle Sam mask, and he's just tearing people up. but dude, the one thing that bothered me about this movie when I first saw it, and always has, and then the one thing that always kind of boggles my mind in this version is what the hell is up with them introducing the weird blind burned kid that was messed up with fireworks the year before. I mean, and because there's like some, like, you know, Uncle Sam's like rubbing on his face, like, "I will do what you wanted to do, blah, blah." And I'm just like, you know, that's sort of creepy. But I guess, you know, dude, the only thing I can think of is there's, I think, some context here, some subcontext that is like, I'm not sure if it's entirely meant or if there was supposed to be in there and they cut most of it out. But if you remember, that's kind of creepy with the little boy in the wheelchair. And then if you remember the sister of the Sam character, when they were growing up, she's like, he did stuff to me that I could never tell mom and dad about, and that's why I don't trust men.
And oh,
And I'm like, so was he like some creepy pervert or something? And because they're like, you know, when the little boy's like, he was always really nice to me. And they're like, yeah, well, you never really knew him.
All right.
And I'm kind of like, does he have like some sort of like goofy, creepy ass, you know, To Catch a Predator 2020 thing going on? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. All of a sudden that one guy shows up at his house and like starts asking about his emails and stuff. Yeah.
It's like, so Uncle Sam, did you know she was 15 and why are you bringing a case of beer? I was coming to tell her why you shouldn't try to pick up old men on the internet.
Right. Why do you have a shotgun in your car? I don't know.
Why did you send her a digital photograph of your burned up genitalias?
Exactly.
I got to leave now.
Yeah. So you're like, all right, well, have a nice day. And then he gets arrested and the movie's over.
But yeah, I mean, you know, seriously, though, I don't know. And that wouldn't surprise me for Larry Cohen to put something like that in there. But it's almost like there was something kind of in there, and then they sort of pulled back from it to make it a little more goofier. So there's a couple of, like, odd things about the movie that I'm watching, and I'm kind of like, yeah, whatever. And then the end of the film, I don't know if you remember the really end of the film when the kid turns, looks at the camera. It just doesn't make any sense to me. Are they trying to tell us that he's, like, still Uncle – is he Uncle Sam now? Is he crazy? What's going on? I don't know.
Right. Yeah, I don't think that was really well fleshed out or whatever, because I kind of had the same feeling. I was kind of like, what is this?
Yeah. So, upon rewatching this, I would say I do enjoy it as a cheesy movie. And I think Bill Lustig make a good film. The performances are really good. I think I agree with you. This might be the best thing I've ever seen Isaac Hayes do.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he was in Three Tough Guys, and that was actually Three Tough Guys is a better movie than this, but that's rather obscure.
Yeah, and I was gonna say I like PJ Souls as a character. I know she doesn't show up, but maybe like 5 minutes, 6 minutes total of the whole movie. But I really think she does come across, and she does the character really well, as like being this evil witch of a mom, you know? And, like, you know, she's, like, totally, like, beats her husband into submission. She's kind of like that woman from Johnny Cage Plus 8. So it's just like, she kind of reminds me of that woman,
you
know?
Dude, did you just bring up reality television on the podcast?
I sure did.
You just compared, like, the evil, crazy mom to the cripple kid in Uncle Sam to the chick from Johnny Cage Plus 8.
Yeah, I sure did, and I don't feel one bit bad about it.
You should, dude.
I know, man.
Between this and reviewing Growing Pains for the YouTube channel, I don't know what to say.
I know, man. I don't know. That's just how I roll. Dude. I have an eccentric taste, if anything. So, but I mean, you know, like I said, you know, the one thing is, PJ Souls, I think she's a really good actress, and I think unfortunately, about from like the mid '80s until even now, she does not get anything to do, and it's unfortunate because if you go back and watch her older stuff, you know she can act. She actually knows what she's doing.
Anytime you say PJ Souls, all I can think of is the Devil's Rejects.
And, exactly, that's so terrible. And gets punched in the face by Sid Haig.
Well,
man.
Then
Come
Sid
on.
Haig looks at the kid and goes, "What's the matter, kid? Don't you like clowns?"
All right, exactly.
Yeah.
Don't we make you laugh?
Nope.
Aren't we funny? Or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
But, I mean, you know, that's the kind of thing. It's like, you know, she shows up. I mean, yeah, she has a bigger role in this movie than she did in, like, Devil's Rejects for sure. But, I mean, it's still, you know.
I don't think so. She's more memorable in Rejects than she is in this. If you didn't know it was PJ Souls or if you didn't know who PJ Souls were, you wouldn't even think twice about this part. But, you know who I actually think.
Well, I would say most people would watch this movie would be fans, generally speaking. Though,
probably. But. I think the one guy that actually does a really good job, and it's ironic because I think he's probably now best known as spending 8 years as a George Bush impersonator, is Timothy Bottoms.
Oh, yeah.
I think he's really good in this. He's like the hippie dude.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, he is. He's very good in this.
And I also think it's friggin' hilarious that he dresses up like Abraham Lincoln.
And he gets killed.
He gets shot in the head.
Yeah, that was terrible, man.
Oh, come on, dude, that's funny.
Yeah, well, I'm a huge Lincoln supporter. No, but I think it's hilarious. I agree. Get shot in the head, man. That's a great dressed as Lincoln.
The thing for me is, I kind of wanted the movie to be a little gorier. It's a little stickier, maybe a little more of the Uncle Sam, like, prowling around. Like, you know, when he kills the one kid, or when he kills the kids in the cemetery, I wanted more of that. I wanted more of that kind of, like, stalking and killing and getting the kids. And the movie just seems to me to get, like, really goofy. And then for me, it sort of just, like, kind of goes off in this weird direction when they suddenly introduce... Because they really do just rather abruptly introduce the cripple kid.
Yeah, just all of a sudden he shows up.
And all of a sudden
like,
the
cripple
kid who can't see, he's in a wheelchair, he's all screwed up from being burnt. He's like, you know who that was? That's your Uncle Sam. And then he's all like, it's over now, or he's here, or it's time. Like, the kids, was there, like, a weird psychic thing going on? What the hell is that?
Yeah, it was, like, some kind of weird savant. Yeah, so, yeah, I don't know what's going on.
For a movie that seemed to be set up pretty well, it has, like, these weird plot devices and plot holes. You're just kind of like, what the hell am I watching? What the hell is this?
Yeah, it's definitely not everybody's cup of tea, but I think it's fun and it's interesting. Well, and it's definitely a way to spend, like, you know, an hour and a half, whatever it is. It's fun.
Here's the thing. I sound like I'm picking at the movie really bad. And there are some issues that I have with the movie. The kid, there's like a whole subcontext that looks like it was cut out for most of the movie, but they left enough of it in there you kind of like scratch your head. The introduction of one character, the fact you have all these familiar faces, they really don't get to do much. So it's a lot of stunt casting, which always kind of bugs the heck out of me. And for the most part, like Robert Forrester and William Smith, they don't get much to do. It's almost basically like, hey, you know, Bill and Larry are making a movie. We're all friends. Let's all be in it, you know, and that, which is fine. I think PJ Souls is kind of the same way that, you know, I think Bill Lustig knew a lot of people and was like, hey, I'm going to have my friends in the movie, which is everybody's entitlement. But I will agree with you on this. The movie's 90 minutes long. And the first 20 minutes to half an hour for me, I found a little slow.
Right.
The last hour of the movie, in spite of the flaws, is fairly entertaining. I mean,
it's
a body count film at that point. As he starts knocking people off, you don't get to see all the people killed, so like weird stuff happens where a body will show up and you're kind of like, okay, you have to deal with it. And I really wish that they had, you know, like had actually shown more of the kills.
Yeah.
Rather,
but they spent all their money on getting all that big talent, man. Come on.
Well, I mean, you know, even like they cut the dude's head off and the decapitation's really fake looking, right? Which is, but then like I wanted to. I'm sitting there going, come on, man. You know when he runs up and grabs the girl and puts her face into the grill?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I want to see that. Show me an effect. You know, melt some latex and pull the face off and blah, 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 you know. Give it to me. I want that. It's a damn crazy Uncle Sam slasher movie.
I want to see some Uncle Sam action.
Yeah.
But all in all, I think the movie is really good, and it's definitely a nice way to spend an hour and a half.
Yeah. Now, I don't know. This is a Blue Underground film, and I think you can probably get it for about, well, if you get the right sale, probably about $12 or $13.
Yeah. Well, it's not worth that.
I mean,
I think it's more like, if you find it. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I think you can actually get it. If you get it at the right time of the year or in a sale, I think you can get it for less than $10, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. Because this Uncle Sam, the copy of the DVD I got, it was in a stack of stuff that I know I spent, like, you know, $6 or $7 on each. And it was on a stack of stuff that I had that I knew I wasn't going to watch right away, but I wanted to have for the collection.
Right. Well, my thinking is more like if you can find this at, like, some, like, secondhand recycle shop somewhere, then I think it's worth it. But
yeah, I wouldn't spend too much on it.
Yeah, I wouldn't run out and spend over $10 on it, that's for sure.
Definitely. I know the retail on this thing was $15-$20. I don't know that I would do that. This is definitely not Bill Lustig's best movie or Larry Cohen's best project.
Oh, no. This is just for good, goofy, late 90s fun.
Yeah, and now as far as, you know, this is one of those movies, though, where people say nothing came out in the 90s was worth watching. I think this is worth watching. I just wouldn't spend a ton of money on it. So, yeah, I mean, I guess it's worth picking up as long as it's not too expensive. That's kind of where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I agree. Like I said, if you can get it for on the cheap, you know, it's definitely worth, like I was saying before, it's a good 90s cheesy fun. So, you know, but I definitely wouldn't spend over $10, that's for sure.
I will ask you a question, though.
Sure.
Your DVD, does it have both of the commentaries?
Both commentaries.
There's two commentaries in my DVD.
Which two do you have?
I have one with Lustig, Larry Cohen, mm-hmm. and the producer.
Okay.
And then I've got one with Bill Lustig and Isaac Hayes.
Oh, yes, I do have that. It was like, I think it was like, it was created in 98.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember reading that. Yeah. Is that common on all of them, or is that like one as a bonus or something?
I don't know. My DVD was like one of those, it's not a special edition, but it's got a different cover to it, and I know it was something they put out. So I think it's probably always the same DVD, just a different cover, but I wasn't sure.
Oh, okay.
So. But I actually recommend if you guys pick the DVD up to check out the commentaries, because they're both pretty good, and they're both a blast.
Okay, great. I haven't listened to it yet, so you've encouraged me to give it a shot here in the next couple of weeks.
And rest in peace, you crazy Scientologist nutbag Isaac Hayes.
I know. Rest in pieces.
Don't hate Isaac Hayes. Hate the Super Adventure Club.
Don't hate Isaac Hayes. Hate Tom Cruise.
Well, we can all hate Tom Cruise. So. Hey, look. We got no money. They're going to sue us for saying bad things about Scientology.
Hey, we don't have no money. We can't get all of our eons in our body. We're supposed to do it. We're Scientologists.
My name's Jason Payne, and I'm completely responsible for everything said on gutmunchers.com.
Exactly. It's my fault. Come and get me, Tom.
You can come sue me in Japan.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm the last samurai now, Tom.
Yeah, Tom.
So
that was actually pretty good, dude. Last Samurai?
I liked it.
A movie.
It is. It's a good movie.
It is.
It's a good classic film.
I did buy that on DVD. I hate Tom Cruise, but I love The Last Samurai. So yeah,
awesome.
I like a Tom Cruise movie, you know it has to be awesome.
You better believe it. You better believe it. I love Last Samurai. Oh, yeah, that's great. Good stuff.
It's a great movie. He does a wonderful job in that film, but
yeah.
I hate Tom Cruise. And Canada.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I have no problem with Canada.
Did you listen to last week's show, or last show?
Yeah, you and Ed going to town on Canada or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had nothing to do with that. All you got much of listeners. I love Canada. It's
Jason
America's
Payne
top
hates
hat.
Canada. He hates Canadians.
I eat Canadians. I eat them.
You want to kill them?
No, I don't.
Yeah, you're Canadian cannibal.
Okay, well maybe if you're from Nova Scotia, but everybody else is okay.
Nova Scotia.
Huh?
Everybody hates people from Nova Scotia.
I know, who doesn't? Yeah. Nova Scotia, eh? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and since I haven't made the gay joke yet, how'd straight camp go?
Straight camp? What? It was great.
Well,
right,
you know...
Oh, that's right. Okay, yeah.
I was on an entire show, and I didn't say anything bad about Canada, and I didn't make a gay joke. So we have to do that. Dude, what would our fan base think, both of them?
Attack Canadians and gays.
It's Wonderlad.
It is Wonderlad. Hello.
If you can't tell, you know, mini me Jason Payne has made his appearance. So, all right.
Okay. Don't eat the microphone.
Huh?
No, I'm just telling Luca not to eat the microphone.
Well, but you know, the kid's got talent.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he wants to put in his
personality now.
Yeah, he is. He's gonna have his own website so people can send $25 and a self-addressed 7 envelope, and he'll sign it for them.
You know what? I hate wrestling, but I'm gonna say something.
Uh-oh.
Is running wild, brother.
Yeah, it's running wild.
I hate wrestling, dude. I really do.
You hate wrestling?
I hate wrestling.
Well, wrestling hates you. So there you go.
But, okay, I think that's enough talk for Uncle Sam, because we stopped talking about Uncle Sam a few minutes ago, but it's okay.
Yeah.
Why don't we take a quick break?
Let's do it.
When we come back, we'll wrap things up for episode 14 of the Gut Munchers podcast.
Okay, we'll talk to you in a little bit.
First, there was The Exorcist, then The Omen and Carrie. But nothing you have seen before could prepare you for what you are going to see in Ruby. Ruby, starring Piper Laurie, Stuart Whitman, Roger Davis, and introducing Janet Baldwin. Ruby, a love affair with the supernatural. From Dimension Pictures, rated R, under 17, not admitted without parent.
The most fantastic weapon of all time is the flying guillotine. Few men have ever been able to operate this death-dealing device, and only one was the master of the flying guillotine. Seymour Bordy and Associates presents The Master of the Flying Guillotine, filmed in Super Cinevision, rated R. Master of the Flying Guillotine. One sure way to get ahead.
Do you're back on the show. How's it going, everybody? It's John.
And this is Jason for one last time, just finishing up my craft dinner here in Canada. No, I'm just kidding, here in Japan. It was yummy.
Yeah. I do love craft dinner.
I do too. I love, man, macaroni. Dude, you don't macaroni and cheese aren't you don't get macaroni and cheese in Japan. There's no such thing.
Dude, I have two questions for you.
Sure.
Number one, can you get tacos in Japan?
Nope. Not unless you go to some like crazy expensive quote-unquote Mexican restaurant.
How about pizza?
Pizza, yeah, but it's not the same as American pizza. They have like they put corn and mayonnaise and like seaweed on it. Oh yeah, they do.
They put corn and mayonnaise on pizza?
Yep, and seaweed and all different kinds of like seafood.
Me, since you went to Japan, you have not had tacos and you've not had pizza.
Nope. I mean, only tacos I've had is when Shoko and I make them when we go to Costco and buy all of our own materials to do it. That's the only time I've ever had tacos. Like here in Japan, what they consider a taco at like a Mexican quote unquote Mexican restaurant in Japan, if you can find them, which I've only found one or two, is that you pay like around $3 for one small little taco, and they put like one little dab of guacamole, a little dab of cheese, a little dab of meat, and a little dab of like salsa in there, and that's it. And then they're like, there's your taco. It's ridiculous.
I need to freeze you some tacos.
I know. I'm like, nah. So anybody out there wants to send me packets of hot sauce from Taco Bell or whatever, that'd be great.
Dude, that'd be funny.
Yeah. I love those hot mild sauces from Taco Bell.
You know, I used to think it'd be cool to live in Japan, but the more I hear you talking about not being able to get tacos and free refills and...
Yeah, no free refills, that's for sure, yep. Yeah.
I don't know, dude. Don't
know. Yeah, it's definitely, you know...
Life applies.
Yeah. If you like eating the American way of life, then eating in Japan is not your thing because it's not at all the same, so... That's for shizzle.
Yep. Okay, so, well, I think we did pretty good with episode 14.
It could have been better, but you know what? You and I, we do the best we can.
Yeah, we do. We do. So, but,
Yeah, hey. Luca.
He's making some racket. That's awesome.
I know. So, well, he'll probably take my job here shortly.
Well, once he's as insightful as you are, so I'm thinking by the time he's 3 or 4.
Oh, dang, that's cold.
Oh, snap!
Oh, snippity snap!
Slippity slew. So, okay. So,
so, do we have any plans for next show? Or what do you and Ed got cooking up? Have you all talked about that at all? Or?
Well, we have some reviews that we're going to do. We have, which we haven't decided on. And there's a couple of interviews that we're trying to track down. We haven't got them yet. So, I guess I should tell everybody, just pay attention to the site and the podcast page, and you'll see an update as soon as we have it. There's a couple of people. I'm pretty sure we're going to have an interview. There's a couple people I have on the proverbial line or chain, but I haven't actually recorded the show, so I always hesitate to mention a name until I know I have it.
Yeah, you're just like Horror Hound. You don't want to mention it until you got it written on paper.
Just like Horror Hound, except not lame.
Except what?
Not lame.
Not like, oh, dang, that's cold.
I'm kidding.
No offense, Nathan. No offense, Nathan.
Dude, Nathan,
I still like
listen to the show, please.
Yeah. I'm going to have Nathan on the show. We need to have Nathan on the show.
Well, we need to have Nathan on the show. Be like, yo, dude, give us free passes to Horror Hound.
I know. We should have
one. Jason from Japan.
Yeah, fly me in.
Yeah.
I think
about Horror Hound. Horror Hound's I've never been to a Horror Hound convention, but the magazine's cool, so... Nathan.
Well, I like their conventions.
Pardon?
I love the magazine and their conventions are really fun. So.
Cool. But
I do agree, John. We should just tell everybody now, all you convention promoters out there that listen to our show, all 40 or 50 of you guys around the world, I know you listen.
Yep.
John and I will be more than happy to come and do our show at your conventions and talk you guys up. So just invite us and we'll be there.
You know, speaking of that, that's funny because I guess – one of the things I do want to let everybody know and remind everybody of is the front page of the website lets you know about Horror Realm, which is the big convention that they're doing in Pittsburgh this coming weekend. And we actually did get press passes, and myself and Richard, who is the artist of the Gut Munchers comic, will be there.
Oh, Tricky Dick. Yeah. He's going to be there. Awesome.
So we'll be there covering the show. And one of the things I can tell you for the next show, we should – probably next show or maybe a special. I don't know. It depends how much stuff I record and how much of it's useful. I will be having some convention reporting from the Horror Realm. So the next show is liable to be a really big one. I think this is
awesome.
Yeah, this is probably clocking. This one will probably clock in around 2 hours. But the next show, we're going to have the Horror Realm report from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You'll hear myself and Richard and special guest co-host George, who's a trip. And I'm glad that I'm going to try to get George on the show if I get him to actually talk into the MP3 recorder. We'll see what happens. And I'm going to be seeing Ken Foray and
When you see Ken, make sure you tell him I said hi, because Ken's a personal friend of mine, and he'll hook you up.
Oh, that's cool. Hopefully we can get I'm hoping to get some interviews maybe out of the show. We have access to the press room, if there's a press room. I'm not sure that there is or how that works, but I'll be talking to we'll be talking to one of the promoters and person that runs the show about the show, because it's very cool. This is the one that started off as the old Zombie Fest, which was a real trip. It was a great time back in, I think, 2007 is when I went. But this is the 09 show, and I'm excited to be there, and that's cool. It's got lots of YouTube videos coming. You've been throwing me some good stuff. I actually had a great trip yesterday to the drive-in.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I went and saw...
What'd you go see?
Sorority Row, I think. The House of Sorority Row remake, which is not really a remake, but the Sorority Row movie.
Oh, yeah.
And then Final Destination. I saw it in 2D, not 3D, but it was a double feature to drive-in. I have some YouTube video that I shot of that, which was fun. So if you're interested in what I think about those movies, you should check that out. But,
oh, great.
Yeah, that was cool. I mean, it was a good time. again, you probably don't have drive-ins in Japan, do you?
No drive-ins here. Yeah, it's almost $20 just to go to the movies.
That's ridiculous.
Yep. So you better make sure you really want to see the movie before you go. That's all I'm saying.
Even the crappy Japanese movies?
Oh, yeah, everything. All of it's like around 18 American dollars to go see it. No matter what. No matter what time of the day it is, no matter what. So,
yeah,
it sucks. Dude. But
oh, hey, there's mine. You know, so yeah, we can't have a show without my dog and your kid showing up.
There you go. And before long, but one of these days they'll grow up and stop doing that.
My dog will never grow up. My dog's retarded.
Oh, poor dog.
Not poor dog.
But yeah, man, I think the show went pretty good for 14. We just keep on plugging along, don't we?
Yeah. So, and then don't forget, episode 16, you and I will be definitely going to review. Definitely have to review The Crazies. So,
yes, The Crazies.
Yeah.
And maybe the other movie you mentioned off air, we should maybe do that too.
We'll do The Crazies and what was the other one?
Toolbox Murders.
Now you want to call that episode 16?
Yeah, man, that'd be awesome.
Crazies and Toolbox Murders, episode 16. You know what it is? Mm-hmm. That's another Blue Underground show.
That's another Blue Underground show. With all this promotion we're giving them, we should probably get some free stuff.
I do.
We already do?
Yeah, man.
Well, that's great.
Blue Underground sends me stuff all the time. They're saying, dude, do you read the site?
Yeah, I read the site. I always see your reviews, but I don't ever know which ones are the ones that you actually have that you've had like for years, or which ones you've gotten recently, and all that.
Well, like all those, Steve's been doing some Blu-ray reviews, and
that's right. I didn't think about that.
Yeah,
that's
Blue
true.
Underground has been awesome to send us the new Blu-rays as they come out, and we really, really appreciate that. But dude, I'm not trying to kiss their butt anymore than I already have. I mean, Underground is awesome company.
Yeah, but
it's some Jalos.
Yeah, but the other thing is that, you know, we do these shows and it's like not expecting any. We're not expecting anything in return. We're just genuinely fans of their work.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It's not like we're getting anything extra from them for doing that. It's just like, you know, we respect what they're doing. We like what they're doing, and as fans, it just goes off into the show regardless. So.
Absolutely, so, dude. But hey, you need to watch some Jalos.
I know, man. I know. I keep always mentioning, like, all over on Dead Pit, like, how I don't like that kind of stuff. But I always end up I end up having to watch it.
I love the fact that you showed up over there and you were like, yeah, man, I don't really like Italian movies, like cannibal movies and zombie movies. And I'm like, hello, gut munchers.
I know, but I'm just being honest. You know what I'm saying? I mean, but that's, I think that's what, you know, you like Cannibal Holocaust or whatever it is.
No, I wouldn't say I like it. I respect it.
Well, you view it or whatever.
I like zombie,
and
though.
I like Growing Pains, okay? I mean, that's where we're at on the spectrum. If nobody, not very many people podcast can say that. That you got one guy watching the Cannibal Ferox or Cannibal Porno Holocaust or whatever,
like,
and the other guy's watching Incredible Hulk.
Well, yeah, there you go. I mean, how many podcasts can say, hey, John, what'd you watch this week? Well, I watched Fulci Zombie. What about you, Jason? Well, I caught Kirk Cameron on Left Behind Part 7.
Yeah, Part 7. Rapture in Philadelphia. Yeah, exactly. So,
yeah, well,
you know, I think that's the fact is that, but I also believe that that gives us a little bit of something different too, because you have your areas of what you really are into, and I have what I'm into,
and
stuff like that. So,
you know, it's like, and you know, with Steve and the Asian movies, and then
Ed, who
we got
the
Ed
exploitation,
who's into all the smut.
Yeah, you and Ed have a lot similar tests, and then I think he might be a little bit heavier on like the porno exploitation stuff than maybe you you were, at least originally. Maybe you've got, I know you mentioned recently you're kind of getting more into that than you had been in the past.
Well,
you're like bigger in the sci-fi,
yeah,
classic Universal stuff, the real big cheesy stuff. And to be honest, and the people probably know this, but listening to us talk and know me on and off the Gut Munchers as Oliver on Dead Pit or on YouTube, I mean, people know what I like is mostly like your normal run-of-the-mill Hollywood. Out of Hollywood or out of, you know, mainstream media stuff. It's the stuff I'm mostly into, you know. I mean, of course I dabble in other things like Toolbox Murders and stuff like that.
With the exception, though, of your Girdler Man Love.
Yeah, Girdler is a little bit different. I mean, I do like blaxploitation films, which typically aren't really mainstream very much. You have like one or two that people know about. But outside of like Fox Brown and Coffee, you know, yeah, most people would know what that stuff is. So, I mean, I do like blaxploitation stuff. But, I mean, aside from those, like, two things, I mean, most people, I mean, like, you and Steve and Ed have a lot more of the underground, more, like, the obscure, you know, stuff that you're into. Or, like, you know, you're willing to dig. You all dig a little deeper than I do. And, I mean, that's just how I am. I mean, I'm willing to give things a chance, of course. And I think people who know me know that I'm willing to give stuff a chance. But I'm just...
By the time Steve is done with you, I guarantee you you'll be a Harry Reams fan.
Steve or Ed?
Steve. Well, I didn't want to say anything bad.
Oh, dang. Oh. Yeah, now I got you. That's Steve. Cold. Well, I'll let Steve defend himself on next show or whatever.
All right. Well, I think we've completely gone off the track, which is what we normally end up doing at the end of the shows.
Yeah. Well, sometimes we do it at the beginning of the show and even in the middle. So it's nice that we
sometimes
do it.
Sometimes
the
whole time show is off the track.
Exactly.
Yeah, so.
We're just keeping it real. We're just keeping up with what we always done, so.
Yeah, so I guess that the thing here is we haven't done shout-outs for a while, so I guess, you know, basically, well, self-promote a little bit. Don't forget to check us out at gutmunchers.com if you're listening to the podcast here. We do have a website that goes with this. It is at gutmunchers.com. We have movie reviews almost every day. We've got a weekly webcomic, which is really starting to get exciting and really starting to hit and have a good time with it. And in addition to that, we also have a YouTube channel YouTube user Gut Munchers. So we have videos there. Jason and I do tons of videos for the YouTube channel. So check us out there as well.
Yeah. And I wanted to say, this as a far quick shout out, because I don't really do that much anymore. Because I mean, you do it quite a bit, and you know, there's no reason to have every YouTube video and every show we do like a shout out from both of us.
Yeah.
But I just didn't want to say that one guy who I've done the trade with the Blue Underground stuff. I know I mentioned it on the YouTube video, but if you all listen to the podcast, if you don't check out the YouTube videos, you should definitely do it. But there's a guy underneath the name Very Crudely Yours,
mm-hmm.
and his real name's Chip, and he's really into the real like crazy like films, like, you know, the German and, you know, the death films and the real like quasi pornography type stuff that's just really on the extreme side, which I'm at all nothing into. But he's the guy I do all the trading with recently, and He does. Cool. If nothing else, he's a wealth of information, and he's a young guy. I think he's still high school, but real fun guy. I definitely suggest checking his stuff out. If you all know Lewis Justin over at MassacreVideo.com, they have almost exactly the similar taste. So
cool.
Just kind of want to say thanks a lot again for the trade chip, and if you guys out there listen to the show, give him a chance. I think you'll like what you see. So,
well, and then we also have our good buddy Ed Demko. And
Edward.
Ed, who participates here and also does his own stuff with BloodTypeOnline.com and the Blood Type Online YouTube page. We also have Steve, who participates over here, but also does his own Eurocult gig, both as a podcast and a YouTube page. So, you know, we got a lot of things happening, a lot of things going. And this has been a pretty laid-back show, if you haven't noticed. Jason and I are just kind of kicking back, and it's not very manic. And I don't have a lot of energy today because I'm not feeling exactly perfectly well. But I think we did okay, and we'll see you guys in a couple of weeks. Hey,
yeah, thanks
for
listening.
And there's my dog again.
Yeah. Your dog's barking and my son's asleep in my arms, so there you go.
All right, so catch you guys later.
All right, bye, guys. See you next week.
Bye.
Or 2 weeks. Bye-bye.